Good Friday to you. Thank you so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, coming to you from Farmville, Virginia today. Glad that you've joined us. Ed Morrissey from Hot Air is going to be along a little bit later on in the hour. Chris Beebe with Heritage Gun Shows. He's got an editorial out saying that President Obama's gun actions are leaving the facts behind. Richard Grinnell of the newly launched Coalition for More Civil Liberties out in California, the opposition campaign launched against Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom's gun control initiative, plus Frank Miniter writing in America's First Freedom about armed citizens saving police officers. We'll check in next hour with West Virginia State Delegate. Pardon me for a moment. Woo, sorry about that. Hate to sneeze on camera. Anyway, we'll talk with State Delegate Sarah Blair from West Virginia, who I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Cameron, Sarah Blair is the youngest member of a state legislature in America. Is that correct?
Just to double check, I looked on the Wikipedias and they said as of 2015. So it might have changed, but I think we would have heard something, you know, as politically minded as the two of us are. So I think she still is.
I think that you're right. Representative Blair is 19 years old and she is already serving in the West Virginia legislature. I think that is awesome. And we're going to talk about a pretty important piece of legislation, permitless carry, in the state of West Virginia, which is up for its final Senate vote. In hour three, Clay Turner from America's First Freedom, what's your vulnerability index? A column that Clay has written that's already receiving a lot of attention and commentary, including from Jen Jakes at BearingArms.com. Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News on WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana, will join us. Plus, in hour three, we have the hero of the day, sponsored by Adcor Defense. Our deal of the day, and our good guy of the day coming up as well. Now, tomorrow, you know, big doings in politics. It's a split a day here. You've got the Republican primary in South Carolina. You've got the Democratic caucuses in Nevada. And then on Tuesday the 23rd, we'll have the Republican caucuses in Nevada. And Saturday the 27th, we will have the Democratic primary in South Carolina. Confused yet? I am a little confused. But tomorrow we'll be looking at the Democrats in Nevada, Republicans in South Carolina. Michael Bloomberg, I am sure, will be popping some very expensive popcorn and probably eating it out of the bowls of all of his guests as he watches the returns to try to figure out if he is indeed getting into the presidential race. The New York Times, their first draft blog, Maggie Haberman, Alexander Burns, writing, Michael Bloomberg hints at reasons for candidacy but doesn't announce it. From their report, denouncing the corrupt gridlock in Washington and wage stagnation across the country, Michael Bloomberg bemoaned a lack of solutions from the 2016 presidential candidates on Thursday night, the most explicit rationale that he has offered for why he's considering a third-party campaign of his own. He said, quote, this has really been a race to the extremes. Said in remarks at his philanthropic foundation on the Upper East Side as he introduced the veteran Republican speechwriter Peggy Noonan at a celebration on the release of her new book. Ms. Noonan, Mr. Bloomberg said, has explained that the current candidates, quote, sense that America has lost faith with its institutions. But, he said, instead of trying to fix it, the candidates are trying to exploit it. Michael Bloomberg would never do anything like that, right? He would never exploit the institutions instead of trying to fix them. I mean, he'd never spend a crap ton of money to change the rules in New York City so he could run for a third term as mayor. He'd never, never would he do something like that. Come on. He said the list of supposed villains we hear about is long, but these solutions are in short supply. The most pressing concerns in the country, he said, were, quote, wage stagnation at home, American retreat around the world, and a, quote, corrupt gridlock and two-party system that answers to lobbyists and special interests instead of the American people. Huh, says the New Yorker who spent $2 million on Virginia's state Senate race and who has vowed to spend $50 million this year, at least, in elections around the country. Man, he just hates those special interest groups, doesn't he? He said that these issues created an opening for the success that outsider candidates are seeing so far in the race. He says that's why you see this kind of candidates out there doing well and not the conventional ones. He says, I know you don't solve problems by pointing fingers or making pie-in-the-sky promises. He says that fixes come from bringing people together around common goals, promoting innovation, demonstrating independence. Really, like choosing the size of your own soda, perhaps, or choosing to exercise your constitutionally protected right to keep and bear arms. That kind of independence? And recognizing that compromise is not a bad word. Just out of curiosity, has every town for gun safety ever offered a compromise? They said, all right, you know what, we'll back off on trying to, you know, get all these places to quit recognizing your right to carry. And, you know, in exchange, you, I don't know, you do X. No. Of course not. The New York Times says Mr. Bloomberg's comments were his most explicit expression of frustration with the state of the 2016 presidential race, and they came less than 2 weeks before his self-imposed deadline for a decision on an independent campaign. So far, the Times says, the 2016 primaries have been inviting for an independent politician who would run as a business-minded technocrat. The early success of Mr. Trump on the Republican side and Mr. Sanders on the Democratic side would seem to leave a vacant lane in the political center. Who thinks of Michael Bloomberg as a centrist? I suppose if you've got $1 billion to spend, that's a heck of a lot of money you can spend on a marketing campaign to try to rebrand yourself as a centrist, but... centrist doesn't mean, oh, I made a lot of money on Wall Street, so Republicans should like me, but I want to tell everybody how to live their life, so Democrats should like me. That's not centrist. I don't know on what planet that would be considered centrist. I would actually think that's a fairly narrow slice of the voting population that we have in this country, but, you know, team bumpkin, so whatever. Mr. Bloomberg's advisor said that he was taking a new and intensive round of political polling after the New Hampshire primary this month to gauge his chances in a national election. Political leaders, the Times says, and both parties remain skeptical that Mr. Bloomberg will enter the race, or that if he did, he would be able to win the 270 votes in the Electoral College required to capture the presidency. We'll interrupt this column in the New York Times for a poll result here. This is from USA Today, a poll taken earlier this week on how Michael Bloomberg would fare in a race against Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. This would be, according to Michael Bloomberg's advisors, this would be sort of the sweet spot for Michael Bloomberg. USA Today says that in that scenario, Donald Trump is the Republican nominee. Bernie Sanders is the Democratic nominee. Michael Bloomberg is the independent, the quote-unquote centrist right there down the middle. USA Today Summit University poll says it would be Trump 37, Sanders 30, Bloomberg 16. Trump 37, Sanders 30, Bloomberg 16. Without Bloomberg in the mix, Trump and Sanders in a dead heat, 44-43. Bloomberg drew 13 points from Sanders, drew 7 points from Trump. Not sure how that adds up to 20. I'm not sure how that actually works there. USA Today says the poll addresses a question that Bloomberg himself seems to have settled. Back in 2013, he told New York Magazine, quote, I'm 100% convinced that you cannot win an election unless you are the nominee of one of the two major parties. A few months before his third and final term as New York's mayor ended. So USA Today saying, well, you know, look, he already said back then you can't. I will say this. This is a crazy election year. Selena Zito was saying on Twitter earlier today that her advice to herself as she is covering the elections is that nobody knows anything because we've really never seen anything like this in our lifetimes. And I think that's a pretty fair assessment. So, look, if you've got $37 billion in your bank account and you can easily cover a $1 billion campaign out of your own pocket, does 2016 look a little bit different than 2013? Sure. Sure it does. Does it mean you can win? No. I don't think it means that you can win. But I can understand how you might think, well, the door is more open this year than it would have been. But again, according to this USA Today Suffolk poll, right now, again, it's without Bloomberg spending $1 billion, again, to rebrand himself as a centrist, right down the middle, pragmatic, not interested in things like telling you how much soda you can drink. Come on. Not interested in, telling you how loud your iPod headphones can be because you're walking across the street, people can't hear, you can't see the cars, whatever. Not interested in mucking about with your right to keep around. I just wanted, common sense, gun safety proposals, that's all. Look, I've got celebrities out the wazoo. They're endorsing me. $1 billion buys you a lot of that. But as of right now, I want to make some sort of feel the burn reference, but what would that be? The bloom is off the rose for Bloomberg. It doesn't look like Americans are really heeding the call from a lot of New York-based publications to get on board the Bloomberg bandwagon. But we'll talk about this a little bit with Ed Morrissey coming up in a couple minutes, as well as the polls showing Bernie Sanders over on the Democratic side surging against Hillary Clinton, both nationally and in the state of Nevada, where the caucus will be held tomorrow. We'll also talk with Ed about Justice Antonin Scalia, who is lying in repose at the Supreme Court today. Saw earlier today Benny Johnson from IJ was out in front of the Supreme Court, and the crowd was enormous. Very rarely do you see footage from Washington, D.C. that actually warms your heart, right? It usually ticks you off. This was good to see. The line of people stretching outside of the Supreme Court, down the steps, around the block. I am sure that not all of these individuals were originalists and textualists and clerks who served under Justice Scalia. I'm sure that there were a lot of people who were just there to pay their respects to the Supreme Court justice. And again, it was good to see that type of response. I saw Molly Hemingway on Twitter said that her kids want to go pay their respects, and so they're actually going after school. I imagine that the lines may even get even longer this afternoon and on into this evening. So we'll talk with Ed about that coming up in just a couple of minutes. Plus, Ed's got a new hire at Town Hall to talk about. And we've got the latest with ISIS and more. So stick around. We are just getting started here on this Friday edition of NRA News, Cam and Company.
Speaking with Shade McMillan with H&M Black Nitride, welcome to NRA News. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, what is H&M Black Nitride? What's it all about?
We are, as opposed to all the different finishes that are out here and coatings, we are a heat treat business. And we service all the major OEMs and single gun customers at the SHOT Show.
How does it work?
It basically is a heat treat process that turns the parts black, adds corrosion protection, and it's a very slick and hard surface.
So it's I imagine that something, besides having a look to it, it's also great protective.
Yes. Very hard, very durable. The corrosion is extremely... there's nothing that can beat it.
Nothing
basically.
That can beat it. And you guys are working with a lot of guys who would probably can attest to that. You got Bruce Pyatt, Tony Holmes, Doug Koenig, all signed on as sponsors.
Yes.
And so why are they using it? Tell me why a shooter would want to use this.
When you have your gun and you're all on the range and in the elements and you're competing, then you can't always take care of your weapon. It's a tool. Okay? It's not all meant to be pretty. What we do is provide that corrosion protection, that wear protection, that makes sure that they feel confident that their gear is always going to work.
It's H&M Black Nitride. I imagine, Shay, this has got, like, implications on it with shooting, with the military, with
yes.
law enforcement.
Yeah,
I mean,
we do a lot of aerospace work, locomotive. We have stuff in outer space for NASA we do.
Wow, that's cool. And you guys are also working over with your shooters here, but also with NRA over at Bianchi Cup as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, Bianchi Cup. My brother and I have been competing out there for 3 years. This will be our fourth year.
Cool.
We were the barbecue sponsor last
that's,
year for
now,
the
now you're
Bianchi
talking.
Cup. And it's a great competition, very family-like. And we're a family-owned business, so we like that.
Awesome. How are we getting more information about H&M Black Nitride?
www.blacknitride.com.
Shay, thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA Great. News. Speaking with Bobby Wiggins with Warrior Outdoors, welcome to NRA News. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
Well, right here on your card, sir, it says Healing for Heroes.
That's
Tell
great.
Us, what are you all about? What do you do?
Warrior Outdoors is a nonprofit organization. We are geared towards helping veterans, particularly with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries. We take vets and first responders to on outdoor activities, hunting, fishing, monster truck shows, to paintball, I mean, just anything outdoors to help prevent withdrawal.
How'd you get this started?
I'm actually a service-connected disabled vet myself. I'll go ahead and tell you, my rating with the VA is 70%. When I was medically discharged from the Marine Corps, I did a lot of my own therapy. I signed an inch-thick book of papers saying I couldn't talk about this, couldn't see, do anything.
Right.
So I went out to a tree stand with a hunting rifle, and that's where I spent the majority of my time doing my own rehab. So it was like a light switch that clicked and said, I cannot be the only person like this. So I started this organization and built a great team to help me out, and that's now I'm sitting here with you.
That's so awesome. It's great, Bobby, to see you when people do this. And out of necessity, what's born this kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. out of necessity was born Warrior Outdoors, because this is what you had to do for yourself, and now you're doing it for others.
That's correct. Not saying that any other organization out there is bad, because they're all good. It's just we can't have enough organizations like this helping veterans.
Absolutely.
We have 22 veterans a day right now. The numbers from the DOD, it's 22 veterans a day committing suicide.
Oh.
One is too many.
How do we get more information about Warrior Outdoors?
You can visit the website, warrioroutdoors.org.
Bobby, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Appropriate to play the outfield now that pitchers and catchers have reported for spring training. Chris Beebe from Heritage Gun Show is coming up later on in the hour. Right now from Hot Air, want to welcome the fantastic Ed Morrissey. How are you, sir?
I am doing well. Thanks for having me on today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And congratulations on the new hire there at Hot Air.
What a great guy, right? What a great pickup we made here with John Sexton. He's been at Breitbart for the last 4 years. Our friends over at Breitbart have had him over there. But he was Blogger of the Year in 2012 and has been friends with us for quite some time. So we are very excited. He's going to start on Monday. So we'll start to see stuff from him starting on Monday. And, of course, he'll kind of ramp up all of next week. It'll be a lot of fun.
All right. I'm looking forward to reading him over at Hot Air. And, you've been talking today about Justice Scalia lying in repose of the Supreme Court, the videos that have been going around. I think Benny Johnson's been online live streaming. And I got to tell you, Ed, it's easy to get disgusted with Washington, D.C., but then you actually see the crowds that have turned out to pay the respects to Justice Scalia, and you can actually feel a little bit better about our nation's capital for at least a little
bit. You can,
bit.
And it's just a shame that we didn't do this a week ago or 6 days ago, that we didn't do this stage of Scalia's passing immediately.
Right.
And we immediately jumped into the political. And it is political. It's going to be political. That's part of the way that our system works. And politics isn't necessarily bad anyway. I mean, I love politics, but I think that we overlooked Scalia's life and his impact. He's on the Supreme Court for almost 30 years, just about 6 months shy of 30 years. And that's one of the longest tenures anybody has ever had on the Supreme Court. And the fact that we didn't reflect on his life's work prior to getting into this sort of ugly scrum over at what point he was going to be replaced. It just seemed to me to be sort of a sad commentary on where we've gone, sort of as a country.
I think you're right, but I think, you know, the politics, I think, is maybe, I don't want to say understandable, but expected maybe at this point. What did kind of take me aback, even though, again, at this point it should probably be expected, were the people who were gleeful, who were eager to not just eager to talk about the politics, but you know, gleeful because you know, somebody that they opposed, their philosophy had died, and now there was a chance to replace that individual with somebody who was the complete opposite of that individual. And so there was this weird, sick joy among some quarters on Saturday night, and it was that was actually really disturbing to see.
It was, and this is, look, I mean, I don't necessarily want to distinguish here because we've seen this with others as well. I remember when Ted Kennedy passed away, for instance, and I mean, definitely not one of my favorite people, and certainly had a large shadow cast over his work by what happened at Chappaquiddick. But a lot of people on our side just launched into that immediately. And, you know, in really nasty terms, started, you know, discussing Ted Kennedy. And I think there's a time and a place for that. It really is. But I think it's after the guy's been buried is sort of my rule of thumb. Whenever that is, right, if it's a week later, if it's 2 days later, after the family's had a chance to say goodbye to him, then it's time to start cutting into his reputation. And, I mean, I understand why people may not like Justice Scalia's approach to jurisprudence. And it's certainly worthy of debate, but you know, you don't celebrate somebody. You never celebrate somebody's death. You celebrate the death of an enemy of your country. That's what you celebrate. If you're going to celebrate a death at all, that's the death you celebrate. But you don't celebrate somebody who's just the death of somebody who's just a political opponent. I mean, that to me is it's just unseemly.
It really is, and you know. When I heard about the news, I was up in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania for the Great American Outdoor Show. Harrisburg, incidentally, is the home of the National Civil War Museum. And we had talked with the CEO earlier that week. So I guess I was just sort of thinking about that. I mean, like, that is that attitude, as you say, which normally you would reserve for the death of an enemy of the country. When you see people celebrating that against their own countrymen, it is sort of a disturbing reminder about how bad things can actually get, right? And it kind of starts where you're unwilling to recognize the simple humanity of somebody. Again, as you say, you can disagree with the guy. You can say, you know, boy, I can't wait till it's appropriate to really rip into his decision in X case or whatever. But he was a husband. He was a father. He was a grandfather. There's a family that is just learning this that is probably in shock. Have some respect for them. You know nothing about them, so you have no reason to hate them. Have some respect for those individuals, even if you can't have respect for the person who has passed.
No, I agree, and it's just so poisonous. And let's face it, Scalia is in a better place, right? So whatever venom that they're spewing really doesn't have any impact on the object of their hate,
right?
Because I think hate is a pretty good term for what it is that we're seeing from. A small number of people. I don't want to overstate this, but it's the small number of people who are speaking the worst that you hear the most.
But it's also, you know, I think we're also seeing more of it. I think it's becoming more accepted to just go ahead and vent your spleen. And if it gets really bad, look, you apologize, you delete your tweet, you move on. You get away with it.
True. Yeah, I mean, that's the social media thing. That's very true. But yeah, I mean, that's the... That in part is sort of like the water cooler thing.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is that the water cooler has this, you know, huge amplifier on it now. Because you're talking about Twitter. That's how I see Twitter, really. I mean, certainly I promote Hot Air. I'll promote my book on Twitter. I do that all the time. And that's fun for me. But mostly for me, social media is a way for somebody who's home officing to actually socialize with people around sort of the work environment. So it's my water cooler. Twitter especially is my water cooler. I jump on from time to time. I see who's there. I start a conversation. And then I go away. And so you know, back in the day, if I was in a if I was in an office, and let's say, you know, Ted, let's use the example of Ted Kennedy, because Ted Kennedy was you know, somebody that that our side disliked pretty intensely, and Ted Kennedy passed away, and we were around the water cooler, and there might be only two or three people around. You know, it's certainly really tempting to make a Chappaquiddick joke or to, you know, vent your spleen about what you thought of Ted Kennedy, even though it's really not the right thing to do. The problem is that when you're doing that on social media, you know, there's a billion people who watch it, or at least have access to it, and it gets passed around. So it's that's the difference. And I think in some ways it sort of amplifies our worst instincts and our worst reactions, social media does, because it's the worst reactions that, you know, are notable, right? And those are the ones that, oh, look what so-and-so said. And then it gets 20,000 retweets and everybody starts weighing in on it, and it amplifies the extreme messages. So, but in the end, though, it's still sort of an issue of human nature that, you know, to dance on somebody's grave that you don't like. And it's a bad impulse.
Absolutely. Talking with Ed Morrissey of Hot Air. All right, so we've got the Democratic caucus tomorrow, in which it now seems to be a dead heat, right? We have no idea. I suspect Bernie has the momentum there in Nevada right now.
Well, certainly that's what the reporting shows. I've been watching John Ralston, who's a great source, and is really the source in Nevada. And that's what he's saying. You know, you don't know until the votes are counted or until the caucuses are counted up out there. But right now it looks like Bernie Sanders has momentum in Nevada. And one way that you can tell that, by the way, is the fact that the Hillary Clinton campaign has spent pretty much every day since New Hampshire discounting the importance of the Nevada caucus. So clearly they see a trend they don't like out there, and they want to minimize the damage from it. But that to me is a really good indicator that it's not going to be a good night for Hillary Clinton out in Nevada.
South Carolina looks like the race is really who's going to be number two, right? Number two, three, maybe even number four.
Among the Republicans, yeah.
Among the Republicans. Yeah, because the Democrats, their South Carolina primary is not until next weekend, right?
That's right. It's a week later, right?
Yeah.
And so, it looks like the who's going to be second, who's going to be third, and how close they can get to Trump is what it looks like from here. Now, again, you don't know until the votes are cast, but the polling has pretty consistently been that Trump is out in front in South Carolina and is solidly out in front with a pretty wide margin. So you're looking at second and third, and it looks like it's going to be Cruz and Rubio in some order. So what we're waiting to see is which order it is and how much gap there is between them.
So I realize a lot can change even in a week and a half or so, but we're getting close to that March 1st SEC primary, Ed. Bloomberg has said if it looks like it's going to end up being Trump-Sanders, he's going to get in. Conventional wisdom says, you know, that's not an unforeseeable conclusion to this election, that it would be Trump-Sanders. New York Times had a piece yesterday, Bloomberg sort of laying out why he might get in, what he sees is wrong with this country, without actually declaring that he'll jump into the race. Knowing how difficult it would be for an independent to actually win the election, do you think this is Bloomberg trying to draw attention to himself in the election year, or do you think that he's actually considering getting into the race?
I think he's probably actually considering getting into the race. I mean, Bloomberg has all sorts of ways to raise his profile. I mean, his profile is pretty high anyway. And I don't see him in the same sense as I see Donald Trump, who's sort of that showman who really wants to be the center of attention and, you know, who's going to keep sort of poking the bear in order to make sure that he is. I don't see that necessarily from Mike Bloomberg. So I think that if he's talking about this, he's probably at least taking a serious look at getting in. The problem for Bloomberg is that he's probably going to have to make a decision by about March 15th at the latest, because at a certain point, you're going to have to start getting organized in all 50 states to get onto the ballot. And you might be able to say, well, I'll only worry about the states that I'm, you know, that I can really compete in, so I'm not going to go in Utah, for instance, and I won't go in Texas. But Texas got a lot of votes. Mm-hmm. Utah, for that matter, doesn't have an inconsequential number of Electoral College electors either. So you want to be on the ballot in all 50 states, and that takes money. It takes organization. You have to start working on that, like, right now. When Ross Perot did it in 1992, he got in about this time. Sometime in mid-February is when he launched his independent campaign. And there was a question at that point how fast you could get onto the ballots and whether or not he could make it onto the ballots. You know, Mike Bloomberg has a lot more money than Ross Perot did at the time. Ross Perot, I think, was worth about $1 billion or something like that, or $2 billion.
Chump change.
And I think he spent in the $30 million range. I'm trying to remember. It's been a long time since I've seen those figures.
Right. But petty cash for Michael Bloomberg.
Yeah, exactly. Mike Bloomberg is worth about, according to Forbes anyway, it's worth about $35 million. And you got to figure that he could probably get to $1 to $2 billion of that pretty easily. I'm sure that he's got enough liquidity to be able to get his hands on that much. So he's got the resources. The question is, does he have the time? And then the other question is, who does that drain voters from? Does it drain voters from Bernie Sanders if he ends up with the nomination, or does it drain voters from Donald Trump, or is it a little both, and in what proportion, and so on and so on and so on? I would suspect it's going to be, like Perot, a little of both, but probably, unlike Perot, more from probably significantly more from Democrats than from Republicans.
It's one poll, and we all know that polling is a very inexact art these days, but a USA Today Suffolk University poll found in a three-way race between Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, and Bloomberg, it would be Trump 37, Sanders 30, Bloomberg 16. And Bloomberg drew twice as many points from Sanders as he did from Trump.
Yeah, the question whenever you have one of these independent candidacies is, where does that guy get any Electoral College votes? Because what happened with Perot was, he ended up getting 19% of the popular vote, which was, you know, pretty impressive, really. I mean, very impressive. But he got zero electoral college votes. He didn't win any states in that 92 election. And you look at Bloomberg, and maybe he wins New York against Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Although, honestly, if Mike Bloomberg got in there and split the Democratic vote, Trump might win.
Hey, listen, Bloomberg spent $100 million to win 51% of the vote for his third term as mayor. You know, I mean, he spent more money than had ever been spent on a mayoral campaign before to get 51% of the vote. So, I think it's entirely possible. I mean, it's not going to be, look, it's a New Yorker. You know, let's all vote for Bloomberg. There are going to be a ton of upstate New Yorkers who will never vote for Michael Bloomberg, where the signs to repeal the SAFE Act are still on the lawns. They will never vote for Michael Bloomberg.
Right, right. I mean, again, the gun rights people are never going to vote for Mike Bloomberg. They're afraid of Mike Bloomberg, and for good reason. But they weren't going to vote for Bernie Sanders either, probably, although Bernie's better on gun rights than Michael Bloomberg is. But Bloomberg is the kind of guy who's sort of like the no-labels crowd guy. He's the competent executive who isn't the, you know, sort of the circus barker that Donald Trump comes across as. Somebody that, you know, people might have a little bit more comfort with. But the people who are going to have comfort with Michael Bloomberg as a president in that direction are going to be pulling from the same voter pool, the same demographics as Bernie Sanders or even Hillary Clinton would be drawing from.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be, you know, the urban voters, the college voters, the graduate degree sort of voters that are traditionally Democratic anyway.
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right.
He's not going to pull the blue collar vote out of Pennsylvania. I mean, he's not going to win states like Colorado. He's not going to win a state like Nevada. He might win in California, but more than likely in California, he would end up just splitting the vote with Bernie Sanders.
I think that you're right. In fact, I think that, you know, given the animosity that we're seeing develop on the Democratic side between Hillary voters and Bernie Sanders voters, if Sanders got the election, got the nomination. I'm sure that there would be a fair number of Hillary Clinton supporters who would, you know, they're not going to vote for Bernie. But Bloomberg might best match Clinton's policies, right? Bloomberg might be their best fit for disgruntled Clinton supporters to go and vote for. But if you don't have enough voters to win the nomination, even with all those super delegates, Ed, if that's your base as an independent, you're not going to win an election.
Yeah, no, I mean, winning elections is all about building coalitions. You have to build a big enough coalition in order to win a national election. Neither party can do it through base turnout unless you discourage the vote in the other party. And that is very difficult to pull off. So you have to find ways to reach out and bring people in. So you have to be somewhat inclusive, and you have to figure out what it is that you want to do to do that, and how you step carefully on policy issues. All those types of things are things that neither Bernie Sanders nor Donald Trump necessarily do well, but Trump is probably better, at least at this stage, of bringing in a coalition that is impactful enough to change elections, and you're seeing it, right? I mean, this is not theory. He won New Hampshire by a mile. Mm-hmm. He's preparing to win South Carolina by a mile, and that is a conservative state. New Hampshire's got this reputation as being somewhat quirky, and it is somewhat independent, and it is. But South Carolina is a conservative state, especially in the Republican Party. And this is a guy who's not a conservative in terms of ideology, and yet here he is with about a third of the vote wrapped up against two really solid conservatives, I would say, in Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. And even if you put together Cruz and Rubio, you're probably still, I mean, at least in the polling, you maybe edge Donald Trump. So this is the guy who's bringing people into a Republican coalition. And I think he's finding new voters, and they're actually turning out to vote. And I think that is the most surprising thing for analysts looking at this thing for the last year, is I don't think anybody thought that Donald Trump could actually do that.
No, I think you're right. I think there's a lot of conventional wisdom, purveyors of conventional wisdom, who have no idea. Right now, they have no idea what the conventional wisdom is. And I think more and more of them would freely admit it, that, you know, this is Selena Zito, I think, on Twitter today said something about how she's just kind of assuming you're covering the election like we've never seen anything like this before. And I think that's a really good way to look at it. You know, I don't think that looking at what happened in 2012 or 2008 is particularly helpful. When we're talking about the state of the American electorate right now.
I will tell you one thing that I think you can make an analog with 2008, is that I think in 2008, at the end of, you know, Katrina, at the end of the, you know, with the Iraq war still ongoing and only barely improving in by the time that the, not even really, when the primary started, it was still looking like it was going south pretty badly. It wasn't until later in 2007 and early 2008 that it became apparent that the surge strategy was succeeding.
Mm-hmm.
And people had just lost confidence in government. They had lost confidence in the Republican Party, very clearly lost confidence in the Republican Party. And along comes Barack Obama promising what? Hope and change. And when they elected him, he didn't really deliver it. You know, the old partisan divisions remained. He actually made them worse. He became basically an ideologue almost immediately, almost overnight became an ideologue. When Republicans wanted to work with him on the stimulus package, but wanted to have, you know, contribute to the language, he looked at them and said, I won. And, I mean, that's literally within 3 weeks of him taking office.
Mm-hmm.
And it went downhill from there. And so 8 years later, here we are, and people are angry at both parties now, at all the institutions of Washington, and they're not looking for a smooth-talking, young guy who can who promises change but doesn't have really any way of delivering it, and no intention of delivering it. They're looking at basically people who can wreck the place. They're looking for radical disruptors. That's the reason why you've got Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump challenging for party nominations for parties that they weren't even affiliated with until, in Trump's case, and not until very recently, and in Sanders's case, I'm not even sure it's still officially that he's affiliated as a Democrat within the party. He's still an independent in terms of his affiliation in the Senate. And so I mean, that's the state that we're in. So I think you can actually draw a line to 2008 and say, look, 8 years ago, voters thought they got what they wanted in terms of change in the institutions. They didn't get it, and now they're back with a vengeance looking for it.
Ed Morrissey with Hot Air. Listen, I always appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Have a great weekend, and look forward to talking to you again very soon.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Absolutely. Ed Morrissey with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Always love the insight and analysis from Ed. When we come back, Chris Beebe of Heritage Gun Shows has an editorial, President Obama's Gun Actions, Leave the Facts Behind. Stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News, Cam and Company, coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org. Gentlemen, welcome to NRA News.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Tell me, what is AmericanSnipers.org all about?
We're a nonprofit, totally volunteer. Nobody makes any money. But basically what we do is we raise money, we buy gear, and we send it to military snipers overseas to do the business that needs to be done.
And how did you start this?
In 2002-2003, we're basically police snipers from around the country. There's a big, I guess, the community's very tight, but there's a wide spread of us. And a couple of us were being deployed as reservists and National Guard as snipers. They were also police snipers, and they needed gear that they didn't have available. So we put that together, started this little project, raised a little bit of money, and then realized there was a big need. And that was 2003. We've since grown legs, and here we are 14 years later, still raising money, sending gear to snipers in country.
So, Ron, going from where you guys started in 2003 to now, what's the trip been like? How has it grown? What's happened?
Well, it's been quite an adventure for us, but a lot of the needs have not really changed. The sniper units only have so much money, so once that money runs out, the guys are doing without. So we're still providing things, mostly sniper-specific gear, like rangefinders, spotting scopes, rifle scopes, gun cleaning gear, binoculars, that kind of thing. And it's the type of gear, like Dave said, when guys are getting deployed, they would call back home and they're asking mom and dad, hey, can you pick me up a wind meter? Well, folks don't generally know where to get that kind of stuff, but we do. So that's why they come to us, and we're able to get them their specific gear that they need.
Speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org. All right, so you guys start this. It's a no-brainer to me. It's a great idea and a great service you're all doing. What's the reaction rolling this out in the sniper community?
We have, when people know what we're doing, all they want to do is help. And where they can help us is we raise money. We sell swag. We sell coins and little trinkets. People give and donate. The manufacturers will donate, but for the most part, people hear about it and they go, that's awesome. I'm upset we have to do that, but we want to help them.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned that, David. Ron, what do you guys think about, and I don't want to get political, but what do you think about that? It's got to be frustrating to officers to know that sometimes they can't get the support they need to get the equipment that they need.
I don't think that's ever going to change. I think as long as we have a bureaucracy that has budgets and budgets get tight, we're not going to always be able to get the things we need. We know that as police officers. We know that as the military, there's priorities. And the bottom line is, as American citizens, we're going to support our military. And when people recognize that and we can broad stroke share that, they want to be part of that.
That's cool. Once again, speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org, there's a lot of folks who don't understand what it is, the mindset, the mentality, the life of a sniper, whether it's a military or police. Ron, what can you tell people about how can they understand best what you guys are, what you go through, help get inside your head?
Well, it's just a very specialized thing that we do. It's something that people volunteer for, but you also have to have the right mindset and the determination and the professionalism to go through that. It's not for everybody, and not everybody gets to do it, but it's a very special thing, and guys who earn that spot, we try and help them out by doing what we do.
All right, it's a big sacrifice. Normally, military police, you're sacrificing.
Right. So give us an idea of some of the people that you've helped and who've benefited from AmericanSnipers.org.
Without naming names, it's been hundreds of guys in all different branches of the service. So we're at events like this. we get approached by people and said, hey, in 2004, you sent us a bunch of gear. You really helped us out. We hear from parents. So that's what we get out of it. That's what we find fulfilling.
Gentlemen, I bet you that never gets old either, right?
No, not at all. Not at all. Not at all. And then some of the gear that we get or we get donated, we get to give that back to the manufacturers. We had a company that donated some knives.
Tell folks how they get more information about AmericanSnipers.org.
Well, you can go to our website at www.AmericanSnipers.org, and that's where they can donate. We always have gun raffles going on constantly of some pretty high-end guns that we get donated to us.
David, Ron, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being part of NRA News.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Welcome back. NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Richard Grinnell with the Coalition for More Civil Liberties coming up top of the hour. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from Heritage Gun Shows, Chris Beebe. How are you, Chris?
Doing great, Cam. How are you?
I am fantastic. I appreciate you coming on the program. Saw your story at the Cleveland Plain Dealers website, cleveland.com. And I got to say, it's a very well thought out commentary on President Obama's gun actions. You say that he leaves the facts behind, starting with where we are in terms of this country, when it comes to violent crime, right?
Yeah. I'm a very fact-driven person, and, you know, obviously there's a lot of emotion involved in some of the crimes that are committed with firearms, but you know, we have to get past that emotion and really focus on the facts in order to determine what's going to help reduce these crimes.
Absolutely. So you say that, first of all, we should not be concerned only with the president's approach, but with what his actions say about this government. You talk about one element of his plan, a final rule regarding firearms regulated by the 1934 National Firearms Act and further regulating those who would own those firearms. And you say Attorney General Loretta Lynch has said that the final rule does not actually have to show a direct link between the rule and enhanced public safety.
Yes, Cam, that's true. And that rule is actually out there on the ATF website. Anybody can pull it up and take a look at it. It became a final rule on January 4th. It is signed by Loretta Lynch. And she, you know, I'm guessing she didn't write it herself, but it is her signature at the bottom of the page. And they do make that arrogant statement that they don't have to show any link.
And in your opinion, are they able to show that link?
Apparently not, because they go on to say they can't even point to one crime that's been committed with NFA firearms for the period in question.
Uh-huh. But this is an area in which the president feels he can act, and so it's an area in which the president will act. You also say part of the president's approach includes a guide titled, Do I Need a License to Buy and Sell Firearms? This was the, as you say, the attempt to clarify what it means to be in the business. We know that gun control groups were actually lobbying the president to simply rewrite the law, to put in, you know, if you sell X number of guns per year, you are engaged in the business. The problem is that the federal statute already has provides a definition of who is engaged in the business, right?
Yeah, the definition is there in the U.S. code, and it's like many laws and similar statutes, it's subject to some interpretation. The thing that really got me about this guide, and I've had a federal firearms license for over 30 years, is they spend an awful lot of time talking about what's going to get you in trouble, but they don't really say what's going to be okay. And I think the NRA really hit the nail on the head with this one. They're really, I think, trying to scare people away and scare people off. You know, when you're writing a guide to explain to somebody what it means to be engaged in the business, and you haven't even included the legal definition of that phrase in the guide, that should tell us something right there.
They don't put the legal definition in there, but they do say, you don't have to be selling guns for a profit. You could sell as few as two firearms, and we could say you're engaged in the business. But they don't actually put what the statute says.
No, they pick and choose. They quote snippets of it, but they pick and choose. And you know, there's at least one part, and I can't quote it off the top of my head, where it's a real half truth, if not an outright. You know, it's intended to mislead people. Is my opinion. They don't include everything. They just pick and choose the parts they want to put in there.
You also write, President Obama could have encouraged actions that would have had a real effect on violence. He could have ordered a review of federal sentencing guidelines in order to determine how Dontre Mills, who used a fake ID to buy and then traffic at least 27 firearms, was sentenced by a federal judge to just 1 year of probation, or how Jaleta Johnson was sentenced to just 1 year of probation, community service, and house arrest after lying on a federal form to purchase a firearm that was then given to Marcus Wheeler, her convicted felon boyfriend, who used the gun to murder a police officer. You're exactly right, Chris. The president could have encouraged actions to do that, but instead, what we've seen is that federal weapons prosecutions have actually declined under this administration.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate. I mean, it's my feeling that, here comes the administration, and they want to chase us down, us being, folks who are just pursuing their hobby and such, and they want to, we're doing this in the light of day. You have the Dontre Millses of the world, and, when they catch it, it's a catch-and-release program. I mean, they catch these guys blatantly violating the law and trafficking firearms. And I'm not talking about selling a shotgun to my brother-in-law. These guys are trafficking firearms for the purposes of crime. I think that's very clear. And they essentially don't do a daggone thing to them.
No, you're right. We covered that story of Dontre Mills up in Milwaukee when it happened, and I was astounded by this, and the federal prosecutor went along with it. This was a sentence, 10 years per charge was what Dontre Mills was eligible for, but the judge said looked like Dontre Mills had been trying to turn his life around. He had gone out to California a couple of times to further his acting and his music career, and apparently, Chris, that qualifies as trying to turn your life around. I didn't realize that. But, again, this is, frankly, generally speaking, what happens to people who are either pleading guilty to these crimes or, in the rare case of these crimes going to trial, being convicted of these crimes. The status quo is that slap on the wrist. It's not the full enforcement of the law.
No, apparently it's not. But they're willing to rattle sabers and try to intimidate people who collect firearms and people who swap firearms for a hobby. And as far as being engaged in the business, and I think I might have mentioned this. They say actually this guide says that you can be on their list even if you're not making a profit when you sell these couple of firearms. In my world, most people who are engaged in any kind of business are making a profit. But again, I think they're just trying to intimidate, these people who do this for a hobby.
I think you're right. I mean, when the statute itself talks about the repeated sales for livelihood and profit, and now the administration is saying, no, you actually don't have to make a profit. You can still be engaged in the business. That to me. You're right. I mean, how else could you interpret it but other than to think that this is trying to chill the exercise of that right?
Yeah, it's very disappointing when there are things they could do that would allow people to defend themselves, really. The NRA said this many, many times. I mean, all these no-gun zones, and the thing that he's really building his house on, so to speak, is these mass shootings by these cowards, and they can't point to one law that would have prevented any of these things. I'm kind of anxious to see what's going to happen with the guy in San Bernardino, California, who provided the two rifles to those terrorists. That was a violation of state law, but, I'm not holding my breath that anything significant is going to happen to him.
Yeah. Well, listen, Chris, unfortunately, we are almost out of time, but I really do appreciate you coming on the program. Last question for you. What kind of reaction has your piece gotten there at Cleveland.com?
Well, I've gotten a lot of calls from people who are just looking for guidance, who just want to know, what am I allowed to do? And, of course, I have to tell them, I'm not an ATF agent, and I'm not a federal prosecutor, and I'm not an attorney, okay? I can give them my opinion, but that's the main reaction. People just wanting to know, average people, hey, I inherited this from my brother-in-law who passed away. What am I allowed to do? That's been most of the reaction.
Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Have a great weekend, and hope we can talk again soon.
All right, you too. Thanks for the invitation, Ken.
You bet. Chris Beebe joins from Heritage Gun Shows there in Ohio. Coming up top of the hour, Richard Grinnell with the Coalition for More Civil Liberties, the new opposition campaign to Lieutenant Gavin Newsom's anti-gun ballot initiative there in California. Also, Frank Miniter with America's First Freedom next hour. When armed citizens save police officers, may have seen the story. I think we talked about it here on NRA News Cam and Company in Pennsylvania, of the armed citizen who came to the aid of a police officer who was being attacked by a couple of individuals surrounded by a group of other angry teenagers there. Also, State Delegate Sarah Blair of West Virginia on permitless carry, a big vote in the Senate. And we'll talk with the youngest delegate in the United States coming up next hour. More of the day's top stories as well, including a puzzler from the New Republic. Millennials, why don't Bernie Sanders millennial supporters care about his record on guns? They're asking. Well, we'll give them a couple of answers. Stick around. More NRA News Cam and Company coming up next.
Speaking with Jonathan Rockin with the Shooting Club. Jonathan, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
Great. I'm fantastic. Good to be here.
Well, you got a cool product. We were talking a little bit the other day, and I had to grab you guys over to talk about it. Tell me what is, and tell everyone else, what is the Shooting Club?
The Shooting Club is the world's first smartphone app that connects shooters across the country in competition for cash and prizes while promoting gun safety. We found that accidents happen with guns because people aren't proficient with them. They sit in a drawer. They don't know how to use them. Maybe you've been to a shooting range once or twice, but if you're rusty, it doesn't really matter. So we found that if we can find a way to reward people and make it fun and give away money, then people will take it a little bit more seriously. So we have a proprietary handicapping system which allows shooters who are very new beginners all the way up to retired cops and military to compete against one another on a fair playing field.
Dude, what a great concept. So, all right, so I got a lot of questions for you here. How does it work? How did it go from this, hey, I got this great idea, to something that you're just getting ready to launch now in the App Store?
The whole idea started two Thanksgivings ago. My dad and I were talking. I was visiting him out in Houston, Texas, and he had commented he just got a new handgun, and his brother, who lives in Louisiana, had gotten one also. And they were trash-talking a little bit about who's a better shot. Mm. And he said, wouldn't it be cool if there was a website where we could upload pictures of our targets and see who's a better shot? My regular business and my background is in web development and design, and I said, you know what, that's a really good idea. We looked and we looked, and there was nothing like that out there, so we decided to build it ourselves. Two years later, here we are.
Wow, that is so cool. All right, so it's called the Shooting Club. How does it work?
So you download the free app from the iPhone store or from the Google Play store.
Got it.
And you find a local range using GPS on your phone if you've never been to a range. At the local range, you purchase one of our official competition targets. You scan the QR code, and then you take the target, which is very, very unique and fun, which is really the secret sauce of what we do. It's really four targets in one. You shoot it according to the rules. You use the app itself, which uses your native camera to take a picture, scores it, handicaps you, and uploads it into your activity feed so all your friends and followers and fellow gun lovers can see your scores.
That is so awesome. What a great idea.
You can even form private groups that are just for maybe a couple of buddies that are for your own private competitions as well.
And I'll tell you what, Jonathan, we're always talking about here on NRA News, how important it is to keep the shooting sports and hunting and everything related to that, the Second Amendment, everything related, keep it vibrant, keep it growing, keep it relevant. And what a great way to do this, to actually be able to merge, because the biggest thing is, people get so caught up in technology, they actually don't go out and shoot anymore. But this merges technology with going out and shooting.
And it makes it social. We found that if you have a buddy that lives in another state and you both love to shoot, but you never have a chance to go together to a range and make it a social activity, now we've removed the geographic and the time borders to do
that. That's big.
As you follow people, you can post your stuff to Facebook. You can form your own private groups, upload pictures. Hey, I just got a brand new 9mm. I can't wait to try it out, etc. And what we found is... is this is bringing in some of the growing interest groups, such as women and millennials, who are newer to shooting sports, and it gives them a platform to really take it and run with it.
Before we run out of time, how do we get more information about the Shooting
Club? You can go to theshootingclub.com or look for the app, The Shooting Club, in your app store.
Jonathan Rocket, The Shooting Club, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRE News.
You bet. It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Well, actually right now, welcome to Hour 2 of NRA News, Cam and Company. That's what I get from multitasking during the commercial breaks. Cam Edwards, your host, coming up on the program this hour. Frank Miniter from America's First Freedom. West Virginia State Delegate Sarah Blair on permitless carry. And right now, I want to welcome to the program from the Coalition for More Civil Liberties in California. Richard Grinnell is with us. Richard, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I appreciate you coming on the program. So tell me about the Coalition for More Civil Liberties. I know that this group was founded sort of in opposition to Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom's gun control referendum that he's trying to put on the ballot, right?
Yeah, correct. We are a very diverse group of people that are coming together to say that the Gavin Newsom initiative, which is very damaging to law enforcement officials and individual liberty throughout California. We are coming together to say we're going to stop this. Gavin Newsom has been very clear that in response to the San Bernardino ISIS-inspired attack, he believes that having more gun laws and confiscating ammunition is the best way to fight an ISIS-inspired attack. We find it to be laughable. We also find it to be incredibly egotistical because, as everyone knows, Gavin Newsom has been looking for an issue that he could run for governor on. And what he's doing is he's trying to launch this initiative as a precursor for his race for governor. So We don't want to be used like that. Californians are tired of having our liberties taken away and doing it in the name of trying to protect us. What happened in San Bernardino is extremely scary to a lot of people, and I think that you've seen across the country that more people want to be able to defend themselves in case of an ISIS-inspired attack. And we think that the solution to crimes like terrorist crimes and ISIS-inspired violence is going to be that individuals are going to have to protect themselves.
You know, and it's interesting that you talk about that, Richard, because maybe a week or so ago, we had a story out of California. It was an armed citizen story, and sort of buried in that media report was news that in Fresno County, California, the waiting period now, the backlog of people who've applied to get their concealed carry license is so great that there's a 10-month wait. It used to be about 30 days. Looking at a story from a few weeks ago, CBS 8 in San Diego, requests for concealed carry permits surged by 9 times in California after the San Bernardino attack. In San Diego County, they said permit applications increased 4 times compared to a month earlier. In San Bernardino itself, a typical monthly average, 80 concealed carry applications, 750 people applied in the month after the attack there in San Bernardino.
Yeah, I think, look, it's a frightening happening. It is the reality. ISIS-inspired attacks and lone wolf attacks can happen at any time. And we just find it to be troubling that some of the same people who don't want to unlock a terrorist phone are the same people that are asking the government to come and confiscate guns and ammunition from people who are law-abiding citizens. And we find it to be, a political issue that Gavin has seized upon. And in doing so, he is making our lives less safe. And the public is not going to stand for it. We've got a coalition of men and women and Asian, Latino, white, old and young, gay and straight that are standing up in California and saying, we already have the toughest gun laws. We've already seen an ISIS-inspired attack right here in our backyard. We are not going to allow self-indulgent politicians to take away our rights in the name of some phony safety idea. The best way to fight this is for individuals to protect themselves.
Talking again with Rich Grinnell with the Coalition for More Civil Liberties. Let's talk about the coalition, if we can. The L.A. Times mentioned a couple of names. Chris Chang, who's been a frequent guest here on NRA News Cam and Company. Los Angeles Deputy District Attorney Michelle Hennessy, president of the Association of Deputy District Attorneys, also part of this coalition?
Yeah, she is, and we're really excited to have her. She's an incredible leader, and, you know, district attorneys throughout California look at her as someone who is thoughtful and who is willing to take courageous stances so that people and specifically Californians are protected.
Well, listen, Richard, we wish you all the best. I know we'll be talking with you and hopefully many more coalition members as the months go on. We are, you know, coming to you 3,000 miles away from California, but we know we've got a lot of listeners, got a lot of viewers there in the state. And California is, you know, listen, it is a crucial state for our Second Amendment rights. There are a lot of Californians who want to exercise those rights, and dang it, it's their right. The Constitution says so.
Great. Thank you so much for having us, and we look forward to talking to you.
Absolutely. Thanks, Richard. Richard Grinnell joins from the Coalition for More Civil Liberties. And, you know, I will say this. This goes beyond the ISIS attack in San Bernardino. Our deal of the day coming up next hour, about an hour from now, as a matter of fact, we'll talk about what's going on in Santa Ana, California. Again, most restrictive gun laws in the country, and yet violent crime way up in Santa Ana this year. It's almost like the criminals don't pay any attention to these gun control laws. It's almost like these laws that are aimed at the legal, law-abiding gun owners to make it harder for them to exercise their rights, don't impact the violent criminals. It's almost like that, isn't it? I'm sorry, maybe it's just like that. By the way, it is not just California where the applications for concealed carry licenses are surging. Talked about Minnesota. Talked about Delaware this week. Tulsa World in Tulsa, Oklahoma, reporting that the state concealed carry license applications have nearly tripled since November. I say one of the most notable jumps between the last week of December and the first week of January. During the week of December 28th, the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation received 744 applications under the Oklahoma Self-Defense Act. Week of January the 4th, the number rose to 1,178. Concealed carry applications in 1 week there in the city. Tulsa World says the increase in the number applies in Tulsa County as well as in the state, according to Sergeant Randy Chapman, who oversees permit applications submitted to the Tulsa County Sheriff's Office. You have had sheriffs in Oklahoma encourage residents to get their concealed carry license. Creek County Sheriff John Davis posted a letter to his office's Facebook page on January the 12th encouraging residents to get their concealed carry license. He reduced the $25 fee for processing fingerprints down to $10. He expanded business hours to include one Saturday a month to accommodate people who can't make it to the sheriff's office during the week. Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation said that several sheriffs across the state have waived the $25 fingerprinting fee and have encouraged residents to apply for a license as a means of personal protection. How about that? I imagine we will see more headlines like this in the weeks and months ahead, which maybe is a good time to pivot and talk about this piece of the New Republic. Why don't Bernie Sanders' millennial supporters care about his record on guns? Asks Adam Peck. Now, if you're a regular listener to this program, you know, we've been talking about this for quite some time, since before Iowa. Hillary Clinton, Martin O'Malley, trying to out anti-gun each other, trying to paint Bernie Sanders as some gun lover. And Bernie Sanders said, no, I'm just as anti-gun as the rest of them. Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire, one in four of her ads featured her gun control message. She got clobbered in New Hampshire. In Iowa, she talked a lot about it on the stump, but her ads didn't feature as many anti-gun messages. Eked out a tie with Bernie Sanders. Adam Pack writes in the New Republic earlier this month, Clinton and Sanders battled first in a Twitter flame war, then a Democratic town hall, finally during a primary debate on MSNBC over the definition of progressivism and who deserves to assume the mantle. Sanders pointed to the Wall Street cash, pointing to Clinton's campaign. She countered with a familiar Trump card, the Vermont senator's long voting record in favor of gun owners. Clinton, Peck says, rightly recognized this is the one issue where she can convincingly outflank Sanders on the left. As she put it in the MSNBC debate, quote, I don't think it was progressive to vote to give gun makers and sellers immunity. Peck says gun control has become a key issue within the Democratic Party. Says, yet Clinton's attacks don't seem to be working. Sanders continues to close the gap in national polls. Do his famed millennial supporters even care about his record on guns? Well, keep in mind, most polls show that millennials are the least supportive of things like a ban on semi-automatic rifles. They are quite supportive of concealed carry. So for many millennial voters, regardless of whether or not they're Republican or Democrat, the answer is no. They really don't care. They don't support gun control measures. Now, the New Republic, I don't really think wants to talk much about that. So they found Arona Kessler, 29, professional pro-choice advocate from, how are you, professional? Okay. Professional pro-choice advocate from Alexandria, Virginia, who says, oh, yeah, she cares. It's just not much of an issue for me. I'm willing to say Sanders has been a little hypocritical when it comes to guns, but not enough to make my support waver. And I do support, she says, stronger gun control. So does, the New Republic says. Jason Mazza, a 21-year-old college student on Long Island, he says, I think we need to be more careful who we are allowing to have guns. Overall, though, he says, gun control isn't really that important an issue to me. Adam Peck says, these sentiments must be disheartening to the gun control groups that have injected themselves into the primaries, largely breaking in favor of Clinton. I think all of them have broken in favor of Clinton. Dan Gross, president of the Brady campaign, which has endorsed Clinton, said where Clinton has come out in front on the gun violence issue, making it a key piece of her campaign, Senator Sanders has only discussed it when asked. Hillary Clinton has led on this issue, and that's going to be an essential factor for voters as the primaries continue. It hasn't been so far. Support for more gun control laws. It hasn't been so far. Even the New Republic recognizes it. A December poll from the New York Times and CBS found that guns were the fourth most important problem facing the country, but the poll was conducted days after the San Bernardino shooting. More recent polling suggested the issue won't motivate voters. A Gallup poll released this month found that, quote, gun policy was, quote, below average in importance to both parties. And yet, when you look around the country, what are you seeing? Record high numbers of concealed carry applications. Saw a story out of the Kansas City area last weekend outside a gun show where an estimated 10,000 people attended. You had a half dozen anti-gun protesters. Among those Americans for whom this is an issue, again, there are a lot of Americans. And again, a lot of Americans across the political spectrum. A lot more Americans across the political spectrum, who say, you know what, we need to be protecting our right to keep and bear arms. You want to reduce violent crime, you don't go after the law-abiding gun owners. Let's be smart about this. The New Republic, in its article here, says, every town for gun safety insists that there's been progress on the issue. Erica Soto Lamb says, if you look at the big picture in recent presidential election history, I think gun policy is sort of catapulted into one of the issues that voters have in mind. Democratic nominees fighting each other over who is better on gun policy represents a profound shift on the issue. Does it? I mean, hasn't this always been like, granted, it's much more overt. Much more overt. Going back to Al Gore's loss in 2000, in 2004 you had, and even in 2008, Hillary Clinton was trying to run to the right of Barack Obama on guns, right? She was talking about her heritage as a duck hunter and going after Barack Obama for saying that those Pennsylvania voters were bitter clingers. 2004, John Kerry was trying to hunt goose in Ohio and wasn't carrying any goose out there, and, you know, just going into the country store there in Ohio, got to get me my hunting license. So, yes, in that sense, anti-gun politicians are much more open about their anti-gun sentiments. But at the same time, they're also still swearing up and down that they're not anti-gun, right? They're still swearing that they support the Second Amendment. They still swear they're not in favor of gun control laws. They're just in favor of common sense gun safety solutions. So I think they are still not being honest with themselves and the American people. They're still in that effort to rebrand themselves and their ideas as something more palatable to the electorate. And again, it doesn't seem to be working out trying to make gun control the big issue for Hillary Clinton, trying to portray Bernie Sanders as the pro-gun candidate there on the Democratic side. That doesn't appear to be turning off a lot of Bernie Sanders voters. Even if, frankly, I think Bernie Sanders is trying to be just as anti-gun as Hillary Clinton. His voters don't really seem to care. Worth considering anyway as we continue following what is a very weird and will continue to be a very weird, historically weird election year, I think. All right, when we come back, Frank Miniter from America's First Freedom on armed citizens saving the lives of police officers. Turnabout is fair play, right? Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Speaking with Bethany Mullen with NRA Community Outreach about the NRA Refuse to Be a Victim program. Tell us, Bethany, what's the program all about?
Well, Refuse to Be a Victim is a crime prevention and a personal safety program. It was created in 1993 by the women of the NRA. It was created specifically for people who didn't feel comfortable carrying firearms, but they still wanted to take a proactive role in their safety. It was women only from 93 to 97, but now it's open up to everybody since people realize that regardless of whether or not you do carry a firearm, there are situations that you want to be aware of so you can stay safe in your everyday life.
So this is a very successful program for NRA. Why was it important that NRA offer a program like this?
Just for people that, like I said, didn't feel comfortable carrying a firearm but still wanted to create a safety plan for themselves. It's really comprehensive. It goes over a whole bunch of different things. It's a four-hour seminar format. It goes over personal safety, travel security, home security, cybersecurity, a whole bunch more. Everyone that attends a seminar does get a comprehensive safety handbook with a lot of stuff that can't even be covered in the 4 hours. And it's just a lot of good tips that you can integrate into your everyday life to avoid becoming a victim of crime.
That's awesome. And the program, Bethany, has continued to grow and evolve now. Way you mentioned cyber, there's so much security, not only around you physically, but online and everything else you got to be aware of as well.
Yeah.
So who's a typical person who takes this program? You said it's not just women, men and women.
Correct. We really have a wide audience. We're working with a lot of police departments because it is just such a great community outreach. So they offer it to their community. A lot of people go to senior centers and talk to the people that live in the senior centers. We're also working with a lot of schools and colleges because that's such a vulnerable age. You know, a lot of 18-year-olds leaving home for the first time. And college campuses, you know, obviously seem very safe, but behind the scenes, there's a lot that goes on. And so we want to make people aware of how to stay safe.
How do you get more information about NRA Refuse to Be a Victim?
Well, you can go online to refuse.nra.org or email us at refuse@nrahq.org.
Speaking with Philip Hosnut with Salted Earth. Philip, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
All right. So tell us, what is Salted Earth? What do you guys do?
So Salted Earth is a technology startup. We're based out of Arizona right now. Been in business about a year, focused primarily on dry fire training, bringing targets to market to help people train anywhere and in any environment.
So when you say technology startup, what kind of stuff? You've got a product here you're going to show us. Is it mainly oriented towards the firearms industry, or is it all sorts of stuff?
We're basically exclusively in the firearm industry right now.
Okay. And what is it that you do? What kind of product?
So this is the first product that we're launching in a lineup. It's part of the Atlas series, which stands for Adaptive Training Laser System. It's a whole system of targets.
Wait, so we get to see the first product you're doing?
This is the first product that we're launching, debuted here at the SHOT Show. It's a reactive dry fire laser training target. It's the kind of the one of the many sizes we'll be coming out with. Has an 8x8 array of LEDs, and it allows you to basically simulate most of the types of trainings you normally do at the live fire range.
So how does that work?
So we have it works with any red, green, or infrared laser. This is a next-level training training pistol. It'll work with anything, including Crimson Trace. Works with flashlights as well. So you can basically configure it through our mobile app to run any standardized training that you normally would.
Very cool. So it gives you an opportunity, a way to train without having to actually be on the range.
Right, exactly.
Very safe, very portable, very anything. So it's the company's called Salted Earth. What's that product?
That's the Atlas 8.
The Atlas 8, and so does it come sort of together as a kit, or is that just a separate part of it?
Right now it's a separate part. We're looking at potential partnerships down the road.
How can you get more information about your company and about the Atlas 8?
You can go to thesaltedearth.com. We have a lot of information up there, a lot of videos of it in action, how to use it, that kind of thing.
Phil with Salted Earth, thank you for this great new product. Thanks for showing it here on NRA News, and thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Your first source for Second Amendment news and information is NRA News Cam and Company. Still to come on the program this hour, we're going to talk permitless carry with West Virginia State Delegate Sarah Blair. Coming up, top of hour three, we have the Hero of the Day presented by Adcor Defense, Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, as well as Clay Turner and Tony Katz. Right now, I want to welcome right in at America's First Freedom, Mr. Frank Miniter. Frank, how you doing, sir?
Hey, Cam, very well.
I appreciate you coming on the program, and I love the fact that you're writing about this. This was one of our Good Guy of the Day stories, an armed citizen coming to the aid of a police officer in Upper Darby Township, Pennsylvania. And so you write this piece at America's First Freedom about when armed citizens save police officers, the shoe all of a sudden on the other foot, and you've got armed citizens protecting and serving those who protect and serve the community.
Right. This is a part of the honest narrative that the mainstream media just really doesn't want to have. That's why this is so often ignored, unfortunately, in so many mainstream outlets. And in this case, in Upper Tarbury Township, but this is a part of Philadelphia, a very rough area of Philadelphia, mostly row housing and high crime. You compare it to other neighborhoods right next to it, and it's double the crime of those neighborhoods. So the police are on patrol there, especially when about the 4,000 high school students get out. There's always police on patrol, being visible, seeing what's going on, because there's often problems in this neighborhood. And this particular day, there were multiple fights on the same day, officers responding to three different fights, and this officer found himself alone responding to a fight where there's two young men fighting with 40 or 50 people watching the fight. Well, the officer had to do something, so he ran right into the middle of it and grabbed one of them. Believe it or not, the other person actually attacked the police officer. I mean, I can't even – that's just so strange to me. Growing up as a kid, if I got into a fight with somebody, I can't imagine attacking a police officer trying to stop this. That's how far, unfortunately, some of these neighborhoods have gone, the way they view police officers. So anyway, they're attacking this police officer, and then other kids are also coming in to potentially attack this police officer. Luckily, there's a good citizen in a nearby home who looks out his window and sees this going on, has a concealed carry permit, gets his gun, runs out, doesn't point it at any of the kids and juveniles, points it in the air, shouts, get back," and protects that officer until another officer could get on the scene.
Absolutely. And you've got the police superintendent there in Upper Darby, Michael Chitwood, says he had the gun in his hand. He didn't point to the kids. He just told them to back off. Quote, if this guy didn't come out and come to the aid of the officer, this officer would have had significant problems.
Yeah, he did have a serious hand injury, and a responding officer had a serious leg injury. So there was quite a bit going on there.
But, you know, you do point out this was not a story that got national media attention, right?
It did not. Fox News did have a piece, but other than that, I couldn't find it anywhere.
I mean, yeah, but it's not like it made the nightly news. New York Times didn't pick it up. It was not in the Washington Post. Which is interesting because, you know, certainly the actions of police officers have come under a great deal of scrutiny with the deaths of Michael Brown and Freddie Gray and others And yet when you see, you know, again, a story of the everyday dangers that police officers face, and then the fact that this police officer was aided by an armed citizen, all of a sudden now here are two narratives, it seems to me, Frank, that the media is not particularly eager to advance.
They don't want the pro-gun narrative. That's true. And a converse to that, or a piece of that, if they're not helping those inner-city neighborhoods or society or wherever this is happening, they're not helping some of those people to deal with the – I mean, here we have a kid attacking a police officer, then the kid fighting the kid attacking the police officer, and then other kids potentially coming in to attack the police officer. Something is really wrong in that community that has to be confronted. And without local journalists and national media focusing on what's wrong there, why are they seeing this way and acting the way they did, why does it take a good Samaritan to jump in, who luckily did have a concealed carry permit, and do that? Why aren't those questions being asked and vetted and interviews happening on the ground and so on, so as a society we can grow beyond this? Instead, because there's a pro-gun narrative there, they just ignore the story.
And another story that you mentioned, Bastrop, Texas, back on January the 16th, Officer Dylan Doris was being beaten by a suspect outside of a gas station. The guy, as you say, had actually gotten his hands on the officer's gun, but an armed citizen named Scott Perkins saw the fight. I believe Scott Perkins, a former Marine. Is that correct, Frank?
Yes, according to reports, he's an ex-Marine.
Drew his self-defense handgun, you say, didn't hesitate, moved in, leveled it at the attacker while shouting, "Freeze." The suspect ran. So, again, here you have a veteran coming to the aid of a deputy with his lawfully owned, lawfully carried firearm in the great state of Texas. I'm not even sure that this made all of the Texas newspapers. I'm not even sure that this was a regional story, Frank.
No, right. I'm actually surprised I came across this one. It got so little attention.
Yeah.
And here's another good guy stepping up. And this cop, and this particular officer, is quoted just crediting this good Samaritan with his life. He said he would be dead. This bad guy had gotten his gun.
Absolutely. I'm alive today because of him. That's what Deputy Doris had to say. You know, I suppose by now we should not be surprised that the media largely uninterested in these stories. It really does take, a really unique set of circumstances for the national media to pay attention to a story like this. But the thing is, and you know this as well as I do, Frank, these types of stories are occurring every day. Every day we see individuals with concealed carry licenses who are defending themselves or others. We are seeing lawful gun owners defend themselves or others, despite the fact that, these are always seen as sort of local stories. There are a heck of a lot of them out there.
They're very common. They're hard to quantify. I mean, I've tried to look at the statistics of this kind of thing, and how do you measure crimes averted? You know, it's a very hard thing to quantify, but it's very common that people are protecting themselves and making this a safer society. And this is why, I mean, Police One had a survey showing that about 90% of police officers support the right to carry by law-abiding citizens, because they see them out there as a benefit to our safety.
Absolutely. We were just talking yesterday with a police officer from the Chicagoland area, Eric Iggy Holmes from Top Shot Season 4. And you know, he's a guy who, look, they've got a whole group of police officers from the Chicago area who teach concealed carry courses, who teach self-defense courses, because they want people to be able to protect themselves. They know that their, you know, chances are, no matter how fast they respond to a call, they're likely to get there after that crime has been committed.
Yeah, this always reminds me of a Maryland sheriff that I've interviewed several times who had to kill somebody who actually was trying to get his gun and then tried to run him down with an automobile. And while he was struggling on the ground with his gun, several people stopped their cars and watched it happening. And a couple of those people told him later they actually had guns but didn't have concealed carry permits. Being in Maryland, it's very difficult to get, especially back in the 90s. So they didn't respond because they were afraid of breaking the law, because they didn't legally have the gun they had to protect themselves. So this cop might have lost his life because people didn't have the right to bear arms.
Wow. And that's one of those scary stories that you don't even like to think about. But the good news is, you know, we do have now, what, more than 13 million concealed carry holders around the country who are looking out for themselves, are looking out for others, including law enforcement officers. And Frank, again, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir, sharing the story. And I know we'll be talking again before long.
Well, anytime, Ken.
All right. Have a great weekend, sir. Frank Menneter, riding at America's First Freedom on When Armed Citizens Save Police Officers. You know, it is fascinating that the media has time for, you know, whatever nonsense story of the day it might be. But rarely, if ever, does the media have time for one of these armed citizen stories. I'm trying to think of the last time that a story of an individual defending themselves with a firearm made the national news. I remember a couple of years ago, it was a New Year's Eve. There was a mom in Oklahoma. Her husband had just died a couple of weeks earlier. She was at home alone with her infant. And she was the victim of a home invasion. And she was able to defend herself, holding onto her baby in one hand, had the gun in the other. That made the national news. That set of circumstances was compelling enough that you saw national news reports. Cameron says the guy at GM who defended the woman who was being stabbed by her daughter recently. Did that make national news? I mean, within our world, it was certainly discussed, but I don't recall. Maybe there was a slight amount of news information, you know, when he was fired.
I think the firing part wasn't like the story a few years ago of the young woman in Oklahoma, like to that level of national news coverage. But it was a story. I do try, you know, like as you said, you know, we do have our orbit, but I always try to see what makes the larger orbit, you know, the MSM orbit. And that did,
right.
That did rise to the level of, you know, your non-traditional places that wouldn't cover stuff like this normally. But I think because of was he fired? He wasn't fired. Now he's being awarded and he's getting a citation, I think from the mayor. So that rose to the level of some, you know, mainstream media, but not to your point. I can't remember the last time, you know, something rose to the national MSM level, you know, an armed citizen story.
It really takes a compelling set of circumstances and I don't know what the formula for it is. Honestly, again, maybe if you lose your job. But, you know, there have been plenty of stories of pizza drivers, right, losing their jobs after defending themselves. And they've gotten local attention, but they haven't necessarily gotten national attention. Maybe the driver in, where is it, Georgia, who defended herself with a firearm, and then she was going to get fired. And then I think it was Papa John said, no, we're not going to fire her, but she's not going to be a driver for us anymore. She's going to work in the restaurant itself. That got some national attention, and there was actually kind of a flurry of stories of pizza drivers defending themselves and not being fired. They got a little bit of attention, but it's rare. And you know, again, there are these stories every day that I think are a pretty compelling set of circumstances that the national media isn't really interested in covering and isn't going to cover. But we have seen, as Frank noted, a couple of cases, high profile in their own areas, I'm sure, of armed citizens coming to the aid of police officers. All right, why don't we take before we take a quick timeout, let's talk a little legislative news here. We're going to be speaking with West Virginia State Delegate Sarah Blair coming up in just a couple of minutes about permitless carry. But in Maine, Michael Bloomberg and his anti-gun groups have apparently met the threshold for a quote-unquote universal background check measure to appear on the November ballot. The proposal, according to WABI, would require a background check before a firearm sale or transfer between individuals. The parties would be required to meet at a licensed firearm dealer who would conduct a background check on the gun recipient and complete the sale. There are exceptions, WABI says, including transfers between family members. There aren't a lot of exceptions, and it doesn't cover every common type of temporary transfer you might think of. The TV station says the proposal will go to voters unless Maine lawmakers approve it. Back in 2014, anti-hunting activists put on the ballot in Maine a bear hunt ban, at least a partial ban on hunting bears. Much like the Everytown campaign, the vast majority of the money spent by the anti-hunting side came from out of state. I think 96% of it came from the Humane Society of the United States, HSUS. I suspect that in this campaign, you'll see roughly 96% of the anti-gun money coming from out of state and groups like Everytown for gun safety. Voters in Maine did not respond well to the out-of-state spending and out-of-state individuals trying to tell them how their state should be. And they rejected that ban once again, by the way, because the anti-gun activists have been at it for quite a while in Maine. That doesn't mean we're automatically going to see that same result here in 2016. So if you're a Maine gun owner, I hope that you will be active this year. I hope that you'll head to NRAILA.org, click the grassroots tab, find out who your local election volunteer coordinator is. But don't sit this election out, really, from coast to coast, no matter where you live. Can't sit this election out. There is, in fact, there is not just about, it's not just about voting. Voting is the key critical component. But you can do more. And this year, look, it's always appreciated in every election. But this year, the more each of us can do, the better off we all will be. So if you're in Maine, you've got another motivating factor here. All right, when we come back, State Delegate Sarah Blair from West Virginia on permitless carry, plus top of the hour, hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy of the day. Stick around. There's more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Mark Gilardi with Shoot for a Cure. Mark, thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me here.
Tell us, what is Shoot for a Cure all about?
Shoot for a Cure, we're a national nonprofit. This is our 14th year. We go all over the country. We raise money for folks with leukemia, people with MS, and various other charitable causes. And since we've started, we've introduced over 1,600 people, new people, to the shooting sports, to sporting clay shooting, and we've raised $2.9 million net.
Wow.
For leukemia research, MS research.
So how did this all start?
On a dare. We were pheasant hunting, and somebody was commiserating about all the stupid golf tournaments we have to do, and somebody says, well, we should do a pheasant hunt for charity. I said, nah, if you do a pheasant hunt, you're not going to get anybody. I said, but if you did a sporting clay shoot, you'd get people to come. And it was like everybody just stopped. And they looked at each other and they went, okay, do it.
Do we have an aha moment?
Yeah.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I'm like, okay. And so we did the first year, and we had, I think, 70 shooters. We raised 12 grand. And we did that for a couple of years, and then people started calling. Hey, can you bring that event up to Spokane? Can you bring that event to Southern Cal? Because we're out in Northern California. So, okay, we can do it. So then we had to figure out how to do the roadshow. Okay, what do we need? We need guns. We need sponsors. We need a trailer. We need a staff. So I talked to people in the industry that I knew. We all became certified instructors. We got a trailer. I came to my first SHOT Show, met Scott and met Carlo. And
how many years ago was that?
That was 14 years.
Oh, man.
So, and it was amazing the response we've gotten. And now we started with one event in Northern Cal. This year coming, we're going to have 17 events coast to coast. My program goal is $650,000. By the way, I forgot to tell you, last year was our record. When I first started this, I said to my buddy, I said, wouldn't it be nice if we could shoot all over the country and raise $500,000 for kids with cancer? And he says, yeah, that'd be nice. Well, guess what? We did it last year. $516,000 net we're sending to those charities. And we had 1,530 shooters at our events.
Wow.
It's awesome. And every year at some point in this show, I will cry. I'm just a big softie.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, you've got, and I love it, you have passion, you have enthusiasm. What? And you've been doing this for 14 years.
Yeah.
What keeps that fire alive in you to do this?
A couple of things. I met some patient heroes a couple of years ago. And when you see the kids, and they're standing there, and, you know, the little girl's got a wig on. She's been through hell. I can say hell, can't I?
Yeah.
Been through hell, and she still manages a smile on her face. And I've got two daughters. And you just go home and hug your kids, and you thank God. And then it's like, I can help. We can do something to help. 2 years ago, leukemia came out with a new form of research. They took the HIV, the AIDS virus, and they took the stinger out of it, you know, the stuff that makes us sick.
Right.
And they retrained those T cells to, instead of attacking healthy cells, they're attacking cancer cells. And there's a video on our website called Fire with Fire. Leukemia Senate said, put this on your website. I cry every time I watch it. This girl was 2 weeks from dead. She was blue. They've tried everything. Just as a last-ditch effort, they did this, and they almost lost her. And 48 hours later, the color came back to her body. And it was like 6 years ago, 8 years, like now, she's living a normal, healthy life. And now, because of what they did with that virus, it's transforming into, it's going to change bone cancer, it's going to change breast cancer, it's the beginning of the end.
Yeah, and all that on top of that, you're introducing people, instead of going to a golf tournament,
right,
into the shooting sports and kindling or rekindling our love for that as well.
Absolutely. You know how many people we see, they're like, they come out and they go, you know, I haven't shot this gun since I was 10 years older. This is my grandpa's 870.
Yeah.
And you get it and it's like, so I have an armorer. Remington gives me parts. We send it to the armorer. They clean it up. They put new seals in it, new piston. The guy goes out, and he's happy. He's having that experience that he last had when he was 10 years old, and we're giving it to him. And we're raising money for kids, you know.
Mark, how can people get more information about Shoot for a Cure?
Go to the website, shootforacure.us.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Coming up, top of the hour, we have the Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcore Defense, our Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, plus a comic book guy from Canada has a, I'm not kidding, he's got a plan for gun control. There's one fatal flaw that I don't think he's thinking of, but we'll talk about it coming up. Top of the hour. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from West Virginia State Delegate Sarah Blair is with us. Delegate Blair, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am fantastic. I really appreciate you coming on the program. I have to say it is a real honor to actually speak to the youngest delegate in the United States.
Well, thank you. It's an honor for you to have me on. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So what's going on with permitless carry in West Virginia? Monday, it looks like, right? We might get the final vote in the state Senate?
Well, it looks like tomorrow. They're working Saturday, so they're actually going to have it on third reading on a Saturday.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Okay, so this is House Bill 4145. This is already passed out of the House, correct?
Yes, sir.
And what do the prospects look like in the Senate right now?
It looks good. We actually passed out a very, very similar bill last year. It got out of the House, got out of the Senate, was vetoed by the governor. We have a 60-day session. We didn't have time to override that veto. But this year, we made sure, you know, to be hasty with it. It looks like it'll pass out of the Senate no problem tomorrow. The governor will more than likely veto it, but we do have time this year to override his veto, and we plan on doing so.
What are you hearing from your constituents, Delegate Blair, on this bill? Are you getting a lot of support for this measure?
Yeah, 99.9% of my constituents really support this. I ran on the platform that upholding your Second Amendment rights is upholding your freedom. And my constituents knew that when they voted for me, that I was a large proponent of this legislation. And I think they're happy to see that I'm running this. And I've overwhelming response. We've ran a lot of big, hot topic bills this year in the West Virginia legislature. And this one is the one I'm hearing overwhelmingly more from than any other.
Oh, that is fantastic. Now we should note this bill, even though it would allow permitless carry, this doesn't get rid of the concealed carry license in West Virginia, right?
No, sir. And in a way, it actually enhances our concealed carry permitting process. We want to keep that in place because that's the only way we could keep our reciprocity with our surrounding states. But this bill, the one that we have, puts in a provisional license for people 18 to 21. Before they turn 21, they can get a provisional concealed carry license. I am currently 19, and in West Virginia, you can't carry concealed until you're 21. So this does benefit me, and that's why I'm so proud to to be the lead sponsors, because if this legislation passes and we're able to override the governor's veto, then I will be allowed to get my own concealed carry license.
So right now you're old enough to fight for other people's rights. You're old enough to fight for your rights, not old enough to exercise.
Yeah,
you're right.
Exactly. And we put in a provision that any military personnel in that age group are going to be exempt from the provisional license, and they would be allowed to carry concealed because they're able to fight in the front lines for everyone's rights, but they're not allowed to carry once they get back home.
That is fantastic. So I've got to ask, Ellie, I mean, what made you, did you grow up in a gun-owning family? Did you grow up knowing the importance of the Second Amendment?
Yes, absolutely. My father and my brother have always shown a great interest in it, in protecting themselves and having the ability to do so. And as a young woman, I'm now starting to see that it's so important for me to have that opportunity as well, especially in the day and age that we live in. I think it's more important than ever that every person be able to have the right to protect themselves if need be. And so I am very excited that we're getting this through.
Well, I you know, we had a permitless carry bill in Virginia as well. I was really hoping that the sister states would both get permitless carry this year, but I think you're going to beat us in West Virginia.
Well, I'm hoping that they do as well, and we look up to Virginia, our mother state, and this bill, we actually did something. We put in a part that has enhanced penalties if you are a felon and you're caught carrying, very similar to Richmond, Virginia's Project Exile, which has been extremely successful in Virginia, and West Virginia wants to implement that same kind of success, so we went ahead and put that in our constitutional carry bill as well.
Really? All right, so that's, you know, see, this is interesting because we talk a lot on this program about one of the problems that I see with gun control is that it always is aimed at the law-abiding gun owner, right? It's not aimed at the violent criminal. It's aimed at restricting the rights of those of us who want to obey and follow the law. Here is a measure that, again, expands the Second Amendment rights of West Virginians and folks in West Virginia, but it doesn't forget those folks who are breaking the law, who have lost their rights because they've committed crimes against society. And so it enhances the penalty. So a greater penalty than what otherwise might be expected for a felon who is carrying who is in illegal possession of a firearm.
Yes.
Huh. Imagine that. See, that sounds like real common sense gun safety legislation to me, Delegate.
Yes, and I couldn't agree more. I think it's time that we start punishing our law-abiding citizens and only helping someone with a malicious intent by making sure that there aren't any carrying well-armed citizens to protect themselves. So.
Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. It is a real pleasure talking with you, and would love to have you back on again. Hopefully, maybe when we, as you say, we're kind of expecting a veto here, so maybe when we get closer to a veto override, we can have you back on the show.
Yes, absolutely. I always love to talk about a veto override.
Thanks so much, Delegate. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
State Delegate Sarah Blair from West Virginia joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. 19 years old, already a state delegate. That is pretty cool. All right, top of the hour, hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy of the day. Let's talk about comic book guy for a second, shall we? From bleedingcool.com, Rich Johnston says, a comic book retailer in Canada, Paul Stock, has a new plan for gun control. He says, simply pass a law that requires all new guns imported or sold into the United States to have RFIDs embedded in their frames. To work without a frame, you might as well just stick a bullet in a piece of pipe and smack the primer in with a hammer. Not the most efficient way to commit murder, let alone mass murder. So just, you know, require every gun sold in the United States to have an RFID chip. He says, if there's an RFID chip in every gun and a scanner reader at every airport, school, or government building entrance, security can be instantly alerted whenever someone with a gun enters the edifice. Uh-huh. Scanners, he says, that detect the things that have become so inexpensive, as low as around $500, that virtually any enterprise will be able to afford them, and staff at ones like banks and gas stations can seal their wickets immediately upon a gun entering the premises. At a gas station, the scanners can be at the pump. No need to wait for entry before tightening up security. Further, the RFID chips themselves are pretty cheap. Most can be had for under a buck. Adding $1 or $2 to the base cost of a gun shouldn't bleed out as a significant price jump on the retail level. So, he says, there's a chip in every new gun in use. bank or gas station has a scanner at the door. Cashiers can be automatically alerted whenever a gun enters the place. Cashiers can simply seal their wickets, he says, protecting them from harm. Or if a scanner reads police weapon, because they can be coded to do this, the staff can probably relax a bit, not just because they know they're not likely to be held up, but also in knowing that there's a professional good guy with a gun on site who can intervene in case someone else causes trouble. So we just need the RFID chip. No problem. He says if a gun's used in a robbery, identified by the chip, scanners can be easily programmed to respond when that chip is read by another machine. So if a chip that was wanted in a holdup at a gas station is read by the Shell gas pumps on the other side of town 20 minutes later, you can send a patrol car, he says. This call could be made to police by an alert employee inside the gas station, or even better, by the scanner itself via the Internet. Boop, boop, boop. He says entry blocking scanners wouldn't likely stop attacks like Paris or San Bernardino because they took place pretty much outdoors. Mind you, he says if random scanners detect a flow of several weapons towards a particular place, rapid deployment of an anti-terror squad could have prevented or at least reduced the bloodshed. He says that's presuming the terrorists use local legal weapons rather than smuggled chip-free ones. Not exactly a safe bet. Not exactly. As a matter of fact, there are a number of problems here with this plan, starting with the fact that you're still, in essence, requiring hardened security at every location, right, where we don't have hardened security. He says if there's an RFID chip in every gun and a scanner slash reader at every airport, school, or government building entrance, security can be instantly alerted whenever someone with a gun enters the edifice. Do we have security there at every one of those entrances, every government building, every post office? Can we harden every target out there? Common sense says no, we can't. Ron Noble, former head of Interpol, says no, we can't. Then there's the matter of perhaps disabling that RFID chip. The comic book store owner, Paul Stock, has an idea for this, though. You ready? In order to improve public safety, because it's all about improving public safety. He says, I figure just about any gun frame could easily take a small hole drilled in it with a rice grain sized RFID dropped in and glued in place. Prevent the chip from being drilled out by booby trapping the thing, he writes. Maybe the rice grain nesting inside a capsule with other contents like white phosphorus that explode on contact with heat and air, he writes. Some would-be butcher kills himself by trying to criminally drill the serial number out of his booby-trapped weapon. Tough luck, bub, he writes. So that's the idea. We're going to equip every firearm with an RFID chip. And then, in order to ensure that the RFID chip isn't removed criminally, we're going to put it inside a capsule with something that'll explode on contact with heat and air and will kill the user because that'll make us all safer. I'm trying to think if this is some sort of Swiftian modest proposal. I don't think it is. I think the Canadian comic book guy is actually serious. Like, you know what? So what? So somebody would die. You know, gun blows up in his hand. He shouldn't have been messing around with the RFID chip. I've seen this attitude before. Back during Prohibition, the most ardent proponents of Prohibition, including Wayne Wheeler, the head of the Anti-Saloon League, advocated for and got the government to poison denatured alcohol, industrial alcohol, because people were drinking it, because alcohol was banned, and people wanted their alcohol. So the idea was the government will put poisons in these denatured alcohol. We'll let everybody know, listen, we're poisoning the alcohol. And then if you die, man, it's on you at that point, right? I mean, you shouldn't have been messing around with it. It was banned alcohol. Come on, what are you doing? About 10,000 Americans were killed. as a result of this. So, yeah, I've seen this attitude before. I have to say, I find it kind of horrifying to have that attitude of, well, you know, people die. I mean, it's for the right cause. If that gun blows up in someone's hand, what happens if the, just out of curiosity, what happens if you're not messing around at all? And let's say the glue that is holding the explosive in place, let's say you jar the gun. Let's say through constant stress of firing that gun at the range, maybe the little capsule there rattles around and all of a sudden drops out. I'm just thinking maybe Canadian comic book guy hasn't thought this all the way through. Or if he has actually thought this all the way through, then Canadian comic book guy really doesn't care that much about legal, lawful gun owners being blown up when this guy's grand idea goes bad. Not to make a comic book pun, but I think I would go back to the drawing board with this one, Canadian comic book guy, because I don't think this one's very well thought out at all. But they're getting awfully inventive, I suppose. It's like an awful version of the worst aspect of a smart gun mixed in with like Death Race 2000 or something. It's just bizarre. Again, what is the? I just don't really understand the intense desire on the part of some of the anti-gun advocates to blow up people who disagree with them. All right, stick around. Hour 3 of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, is coming up right after this. Hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy of the day, Clay Turner from America's First Freedom, Tony Katz from Tony Katz in the Morning News, and more of the day's top Second Amendment stories all in the next 60 minutes. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Here in Nashville, Tennessee, NRA annual meetings. It's Dan Quall from NRA Hearing Benefits. Dan, this would be a good place today because the wall of guns is over there. It's really loud. So hearing benefits is very important right now.
Absolutely. I mean, we're here doing a couple of three things. Number one, ear protection. So we are promoting that. And this wall of guns reminds us that we have to protect the hearing that we have. So it's very important to do that. So
we, of course, NRA members and the NRA, it's all about safety and respecting the firearm. But it seems to me, you know, when we talk about eyes and ears, people sometimes can be forgetful. And when you look at some of the statistics and the data of the decibels that come out and can damage your ear, I mean, talk about what you see.
Well, the studies are really clear. I mean, the sound level that's produced from a gunshot, even in an open environment, is going to create some damage. It's just the impact noise is that significant. And you do it repeatedly, and you're going to have what we call permanent sensory neural or nerve damage. Now, what that means is some of the hair follicles in the inner ear have been damaged, and so then what we have to do is we have to look at some way to try to compensate that. So two things that usually are the indicators. Number one is ringing in the ears. We start to get what we call tinnitus. And so that's an indicator and usually a sign, need to get your ears tested, let's see what's going on. And then the other aspect is just what we call just flat-out nerve damage, sensory neural damage. And so where people can hear, but they don't understand the words. So they think, I hear fine, but sometimes it sounds like people are mumbling, or when I get around a lot of noise, I can't understand. And that's a sign of a high-frequency hearing loss and very typical of shooting. And, in fact, that's where I got mine, shooting and running boats. And so here I am, an audiologist, and I forget about putting the protection on, and now here I am wearing devices.
Do you have any clients?
Surprisingly. And surprisingly, they relate. Once I show them, they realize that, hey, you didn't do the things you should have done either.
So NRA hearing benefits, what exactly does that provide?
Well, you know, the NRA is so good to its members. It takes its membership, and it goes out and uses it to leverage and create savings for them. And so Starkey Hearing Technologies started working with the NRA many years ago to provide discounts for NRA members to save money on buying a hearing aid. So when you come through us, you can expect to save anywhere from 25 to 40% on the cost of hearing aids out in the marketplace. And that's all thanks to the NRA and what they've, you know, gone to bat for the folks, you know, for all their members. And so it's a really great benefit. And hearing aids today are so much different from what they were even 5 years ago. Yeah. Our president gave us a talk the other day. The computing power in a hearing aid that I'm wearing right now, it has more computing power than the computers they use to land a man on the moon. And now we've got it at the size that fits onto the top of our ears. So we can manipulate sounds, help control background noise, link directly into your phone. I can stream right from my phone into my hearing aids. I don't have to hold it up to my ear. And so just amazing technology. 1 out of 10 people in the U.S. has a hearing loss. And of that group, less than 10% will be a surgical or medical. So about 90% are going to require some kind of amplification correction.
So a lot of people that could benefit from this, where should they go online?
NRAHearingBenefits.com. Or go to the NRA site, and we're listed on there too. But if you remember Hearing Benefits, NRAHearingBenefits.com, you'll find us. And we have what are called hearing care advisors that are on the phone to help guide a person through the whole process of getting tested and seeing if a hearing aid makes sense for them. So
sounds great. Thank you very much, Dan.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Welcome back. Hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler, starts right now. Hero of the Day, sponsored by Accor Defense. Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, Clay Turner from America's First Freedom, Mr. Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News, talking about some of the big news of the week. And a couple more problems here with that Canadian comic book store owner's idea for gun control. Explosive RFID chips in the glued into the base of every gun sold or imported into the United States, and then when you'd walk into a gas station, for instance, or even be at the pumps, the clerk would be alerted that you had a firearm, and then their wickets would be secured somehow. And this would only add maybe like a buck or two to the cost of the gun, says Canadian comic book store guy. Right? Do you think it's only going to cost a couple bucks more to install an RFID chip that's encased in a capsule filled with explosives that will detonate upon light and air? I'm guessing that's probably going to require some retooling there at the factory in order to actually make that firearm possible. So I'm guessing there's got to be more than just a buck or two added to the cost of the gun. Secondly, you know, we do have a thing called the right to bear arms in this country, right? So the vast majority of people who might pull up to the pump at a gas station, triggering said RFID chip, shutting down the gas stations that is hermetically sealed and nobody can gain entry, well, they're not going to be armed robbers, are they? And they're going to be legal, law-abiding gun owners. And so why would you want a system that would constantly be locking up your gas station tighter than a drum so that your legal, law-abiding, paying customers can't come inside your gas station, grocery store, bank, whatever? This is multiple levels of just not a good idea. Starting with the idea of putting a little bit of explosive right there in the base of the gun so that if it's ever exposed to air or sunlight, the gun will explode, killing the user. I think starting from there, that's probably the worst part of the idea. And then there are just other levels of what the heck is he thinking? It goes hand in hand with that. All right, let's get to our hero of the day today, shall we? And gun control advocates, don't take your idea. Well, I mean, actually, you know what? Now that I think about it, run with it, gun control advocates. Go. Take Canadian gun comic book store guys' plans and run with it. I think you should build a multi-million dollar campaign based around the idea of putting these little tiny high explosives in the base of guns. I think the American people are ready for it. All right. Hero of the day, sponsored by Adcor Defense, from Pitt County, North Carolina, WITN. They say deputies now have charged two men, have warrants out for a third after a home invasion where the victim opened fire. 19-year-old Ryan H., 23-year-old Deshaun Dale have both been charged with attempted robbery with a dangerous weapon and first-degree burglary. They say Danny Lewis of Greenville, North Carolina, is going to face similar charges once he gets out of the hospital. Pitt County deputies say the three tried to rob a home in Grimesland on Tuesday night, but one resident fought back. Mary Johnson lives in the mobile home with her boyfriend, Nathaniel Rimbert. Johnson told WITN that she and Rimbert, along with her 14-month-old, were in the living room when three men snapped open the locked screen door. Mary Johnson grabbed her son, ran to a back room. She says Rimbert managed to get his revolver and unloaded the weapon, firing six times. She said the three men dropped their shotgun and ran out. A few minutes later, troopers were called to a vehicle in a ditch on Highway 33. Inside the vehicle was a man with a gunshot wound to his arm, as well as another man who was uninjured. Mary Johnson says that she and her son left the home that night, spent the night with her mom before returning to the home the next day. She says that she saw the third suspect actually walking down Highway 33. So she called deputies and says that they picked him up as well. Deputies say the man walking down the road was Deshaun Dale. Mary Johnson says she has no idea why somebody would come to their home to rob them. She says they don't have anything valuable. Right now, Ryan H., Deshaun Dale, both being held on a $300,000 secured bond. I will say this, Mary Johnson does have several valuable things there in that home, although I don't know if that's what the trio of suspects were looking for. But her life is valuable. Her boyfriend's life is valuable. Their 14-month-old son's life is valuable and worth protecting and defending. Glad that Nathaniel Rimbert was able to do so. We'll keep our eyes on this story, but right now it looks like a case of self-defense. And that boyfriend there, Mr. Rimbert, our hero of the day. Now, our deal of the day comes from the Orange County Register in Orange County, California. I said we're going to talk about what's going on in Santa Ana. This is a headline yesterday, Santa Ana's third shooting in 3 days being investigated. Luis Cassiano Jr. reporting police officials investigating a possible shooting in Santa Ana near the site where a police officer and a gang member exchanged gunfire on Wednesday. It was around 4:15 p.m. Thursday afternoon. Man went to a hospital with a gunshot wound. Condition of the man not immediately available. Officers had received calls of shots fired there at the corner of McFadden Avenue and South Sullivan Street earlier in the day. 3:30 Wednesday afternoon, day earlier, gang officers near the 2700 block of McFadden came into contact with 30-year-old Carlos Michael Rodriguez, age 30, a criminal member that the OC Register describes as having a long criminal history. Rodriguez fired at a detective, leaving him with a graze wound to the head. The detective returned fire. Rodriguez was hit in his upper and lower torso. Two handguns were found at the scene. Since January, the Orange County Register says there have been more than 50 shootings in Santa Ana, 82 assaults with deadly weapons, most of the incidents gang-related. In other words, most of the incidents, the individuals responsible have a criminal record. They are not legally in possession of those firearms anyway. California has some of the most restrictive gun control laws in the country on the books, and they don't seem to be helping. But I wanted to learn a little bit more about Carlos Michael Rodriguez, described as being a 30-year-old gang member with a, quote, lengthy criminal history. And the Orange County Register did have, earlier in the week, a story that had a little bit more information about Mr. Rodriguez. Orange County Register's Alma Fausto says that the suspect, Carlos Michael Rodriguez, previously served time in prison for assaulting a police officer. Yeah, the guy who shot at a police officer previously served time in prison for assaulting a police officer. What are the odds? Corporal Anthony Bertagna said it is still unclear what happened between the detective and Rodriguez before the shooting in the gang-plagued area. Two handguns officers believe belonged to the suspect found at the scene. Rodriguez is still recovering. He will be booked on charges of attempted murder of an officer, possession of a gun within a school zone, gang member possession of a gun, and possession of a concealed weapon. He faces sentence enhancements for being involved in a gang. Wednesday's altercation, not his first assault on law enforcement, according to authorities. He was released from prison back in September of 2015. Orange County Register says, after serving 8 years for assault with a deadly weapon on a Santa Ana police officer. I'm not sure he served 8 years. I think he might have gotten an 8-year sentence. I don't think he served 8 years. Because the Orange County Register says, in 2009, he pleaded guilty to assault with a semi-automatic rifle, possessing a firearm as a felon, resisting an executive officer, and possession of a controlled substance. That was in 2009. He was released in 2015. That's not 8 years, right? California's been letting a lot of criminals out early. They've been moving some criminals from state prison to the county jail, which in turn means that there aren't enough spaces available for individuals to be held on bond before trial. So you've got people who are bonded out and then in some cases not showing up for trial. Anyway, this was Mr. Rodriguez's last stint in prison, where he may have done close to 6 years of an 8-year sentence. By the way, if he had been charged in federal court simply for felon in possession of a firearm, he would have been eligible for a 10-year sentence. He would have had to do 85% before he was released. In 2006, he pleaded guilty to possession of a controlled substance and paraphernalia, as well as violating a protective order. In April of 2005, he pleaded guilty to unlawful taking of a vehicle, buying or receiving stolen vehicle equipment, possession of burglary tools, possession of a controlled substance. In 2004, he pleaded guilty to inflicting injury on an elder adult and a vandalism charge, basically for over a decade now. 2004, by the way, takes us to when he turned 18 and was an adult. Don't know if there are charges as a juvenile. But in essence, every year that Mr. Rodriguez has been an adult and has been on the streets for some brief period of time, he has broken the law and ended up behind bars for an unspecified period of time. So 30-year-old Carlos Michael Rodriguez is today's deal of the day. And the sad thing is, I imagine that there are quite a few more offenders there in the Santa Ana area, just Santa Ana, whose criminal history bears a shocking resemblance to that of Carlos Michael Rodriguez. All right, our good guy of the day. We just talked with Frank Miniter last hour about armed citizens coming to the aid of police officers. Well, here's the story of an unarmed citizen coming to the aid of a police officer. From ABC and Fox in Montana, KFBB. There was a high-speed chase in Great Falls, Montana. Ended up with the suspect in this pursuit running into a building that houses both a daycare and a preschool. Brent Ebby is the individual. Started on a Wednesday morning high-speed chase in Great Falls. Brett Ebby ditched his vehicle on Central Avenue. Great Falls Police Department Sergeant Jim Wells said, shortly thereafter, we thought the suspect had gone into a house, and we surrounded that house. Turns out he had not. Brett Ebby had instead taken off towards the Ursuline Center, which is a historic building in Great Falls. It houses a daycare center, a preschool on the lower level. Outside of the Ursuline Center, a Paris Gibson education student named Paige, who doesn't really want her last name being used, I can understand that, 17-year-old Paige said that she spotted Brett Ebby right away. She said she was on the sidewalk. She saw a guy that looked suspicious. She says she saw a man matching his description jump the fence near the Ursuline Center, attempt to open several doors before finally finding an unlocked one and running inside the building. Paige said, I was like, there's something not right. And everything screamed, I need to go get help. And then Great Falls Police Department School Resource Officer, Detective Corey Reeves, stepped in. Said, after hearing the radio traffic, Paige called me saying, I think this is the guy you're looking for, and she described him to me. I was able to communicate via the radio to patrol officers. Officers did surround the Ursuline Center. Several of them stayed in the daycare and preschool. Less than 50 minutes after the high-speed chase began, officers found Brett Ebby hiding in a closet on the fourth floor of the Ursa Lyne Center. Ebby, described by KFBB, as having a lengthy criminal record as well. Two prior DUI convictions, felony theft conviction, three prior no insurance violations, among several others. Children were injured or hurt. And in fact, there's no indication that Brett Ebby, despite his criminal record, had plans to hurt the children. But for the quick-thinking 17-year-old, still able to come to the aid of officers and help take Mr. Ebby into custody. She said, "I don't want to see people get hurt. And you can make a difference by saying a few words." She says, "It's tough, but it's a domino effect. You make a difference by saying a few words." Well, Paige, we thank you for speaking up, for speaking out, for being in the right place at the right time, and for taking that additional step and doing the right thing. And for that, we thank you for being one of the very many good guys out there. All right. Still to come on the program this hour, Mr. Clay Turner from America's First Freedom, talking about your vulnerability index, a new piece at America's First Freedom. Also, Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz and the Morning News, coming up later on in the hour as well. We're also continuing to follow all of the latest Second Amendment news and information for you. We'll talk about a right to carry bill in Alabama, had a public hearing. Sounds like there was pretty good turnout for it. Sounds like there was a lot of discussion about it. We'll give you all the details later in the hour. So stick around. We'll be right back with much more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Speaking with Jim Sapega, director of the NRA Museums, the National Firearms Museum, what's it all about?
Well, you know, we got three museums now. We used to be the museum. Now we're three museums, and this is the home museum, the NRA National Firearms Museum. This is our 80th year of existence, and we are here at the NRA headquarters building. We've got about 3,000 firearms on display, and we have a number of spectacular new exhibits that have just popped up this past year. Usually it's exciting to get maybe one exhibit every other year, but this year we've got a great steampunks guns exhibit that shows fanciful guns that are artists' creations from steampunk fantasy. And then we compare those to actual guns from the Victorian era that kind of have the same sensibility about them and see if you can tell what's real and what's fake. We've also put in exhibits on America's pistol. And I'm very excited about this one. We have been able to reunite for the first time in a century the two actual pistols that did the head-to-head shootout in 1911 for the U.S. Army to pick their issue sidearm, the Savage Model 1911 45 ACP and the Colt Model 1911, both in 45 ACP, and of course the Colt won that head-to-head challenge. But these were the actual guns that were used in those trials, along with a number of other guns that were experimental models leading up to that.
Right, before we run out of time, how do folks get more information about the NRA National Firearms Museum?
Well, they can come visit us at the NRA headquarters in Fairfax, Virginia. If they can't get by, they can come visit us on the website nramuseums.com.
All right, Jim Sapega, director of the NRA Museums. That's the NRA National Firearms Museum here in Fairfax. Thank you for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you, John.
I'm speaking with Sergeant Major Lance Nutt. He's president and founder of Sheepdog Impact Assistance. Tell us what Sheepdog Impact Assistance is all about.
Well, when we refer to the term of sheepdog, it's referring to one of society's protectors. It's the men and women that serve in the military, law enforcement, fire and rescue ranks. It's that type of man or woman that's willing to put their life on the line for you and me, for everyday service and the things that we live and take for granted. It takes a unique individual to go out there and make sure that we're able to appreciate the freedoms that exist for us. And when we talk about society's protectors, it's truly its sheepdogs, those men and women willing to give it all.
So where did this concept come from?
Well, for us and myself as a Marine of 28 years, it was quickly understanding with multiple deployments under my back and so many of my own Marines and soldiers and sailors that I had served with, seeing the difficulties they had in returning home. Part of that was that continued service opportunity. When you step away from something that means so much to you and having given so much of your life in service, we felt that we needed an organization that would give you that opportunity to continue giving back to your country. And we initially formed as a disaster response organization and have morphed into so much more that truly defines who and what we are as individuals, our members and our volunteers. But more importantly, we're making sure that those men and women that have suffered a traumatic injury, and that could be emotional or physical trauma, that we give them the opportunity to get up off their butts and continue to live their lives.
It's awesome. Sergeant Major Lance Nutt with Sheepdog Impact Assistance. How can we get more information about your wonderful organization?
Well, we encourage people to visit our website at www.sheepdogia.org, and that's that'll give them an opportunity to learn a lot more about what we're accomplishing and how we're helping these men and women continue on with their lives.
Thanks, sir. Thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. We've got Mr. Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News on WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana, coming up in just a little bit. Right now, I want to welcome back to the program from America's First Freedom, Clay Turner, the creative director there at America's First Freedom. How are you doing this afternoon, sir?
I'm terrific, Cam. How about you?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program. You've got a piece in America's First Freedom right now. What is your vulnerability index? And I know that you're pleased that a lot of people are talking about this and taking this idea and running with it.
Yeah, I am. I saw that we made Media Matters hit list, which is always a high point of my day. So, but the vulnerability index, it's an idea that we've been kicking around here at americasfirstfreedom.org for about a year. And it sprang from a conversation I was having from a friend of mine. All of us have a friend like this guy who's a good friend. He's a great guy. You like him, but you just have differing opinions on guns. And you see him at the coffee shop every week, and you have this loud, haranguing, friendly conversation going on. This goes on for weeks, and one day, Mike, who is retired, and he likes to go motorcycling across the desert, and he's gone for weeks at a time. And one day he looks at me across the table and he goes, you know, I got to thinking about you the other day. I'm out there motorcycling. I'm camping in the desert by the side of the road, and my eyes are shot and I can't hear so well, and my knees are shot. And I got to thinking, if somebody wanted a piece of me, yeah, I wouldn't be able to do much about it. Maybe I ought to get a gun. He kind of smiles, and I didn't gloat much, but it got me thinking about it, that Mike's circumstances have changed. And as they've changed, he's beginning to think, wow, I'm more vulnerable than I used to be. And maybe I ought to rejigger my thinking about how I mitigate those risks.
You know, it's interesting because you talk about like the health factors, but you also talk about environmental factors. And one of the first sort of hypothetical situations that you lay out, you say your car breaks down. Are you more or less vulnerable while changing a tire in the dark? This was actually the circumstance that made my wife decide to get her concealed carry license, because she's a very kind, a generous person. She likes to help people out. And she was driving down the Beltway one evening, and she saw somebody off to the side of the road who needed help changing their tire. But it was after dark, and, you know, there have been instances where people pose as distressed motorists, and then they rob you. And she drove by, and she felt bad about driving by, because her inclination was to help, right? And so she thought to herself, you know, I don't want to be defenseless. I don't want to be in a position where I feel like I can't help people and I would like to because I can't protect myself. And so that was actually, you know, her kind of magic moment of thinking, all right, I want to do more.
You know, and I think she's a good example of what happens to all of us. We're fortunate enough to walk around in condition white most of the time, where we're just kind of oblivious to what might happen to us. You know, we're very lucky people as Americans for the most part. But something will happen that makes you think, you know, maybe I ought to rethink this. Maybe I'm not as safe as I think that I am. You know, for me, one of my first ones was when my daughter called me up one time and said, can you stay on the phone with me while I go into my house? I go, well, sure. Why? She goes, well, because the door from the garage to the house is open, and I'm sure I closed it. And of course, as a dad, I say to me, I was just not ready for that conversation. I said, yeah, I'll stay on the phone with you. You bet. And I got to thinking to myself, what am I going to do if she has a problem? Am I going to yell at the guy over the cell phone?
Right.
I mean, I didn't have a firearm. So, but the more you think about your daily circumstance, your health is just one thing. I mean, I may be perfectly healthy. What if I have knee surgery? What if I have diabetes? I mean, what if I'm getting to be 67 years old? My eyesight doesn't work so good. What if I got hearing aids? I can't hear somebody approaching me from behind anymore. And that's the health aspect is one part of it, but you're changing circumstances. You take a different job, you get a divorce, you move to a trailer park. These kinds of things have a huge impact on your vulnerability as well. But all those pale in comparison to the choices that we make daily, which, let's say I decided I'm going to go to Mardi Gras. How much more vulnerable am I at Mardi Gras than as if I'm here at home? Let's talk about that some more. You're going to be in the French Quarter. You're going to be there after 2 a.m. You're going to be drinking a bunch. Where are you staying? Are you staying in a reputable part of town? Are you taking a taxi back and forth? The more you ask, the more aware you are of these kinds of choices and how they affect your vulnerability, and aware of how you might be able to mitigate those things.
Absolutely. And by the way, this is not to say that you won't go to the French Quarter and you won't enjoy Mardi Gras. But if you are aware of these things, you're also maybe going to be more likely to say, okay, who's going to be the sober one in this group of people, right? Who's going to be the person who actually has their wits about them? It's interesting because it's not that at some point you think to yourself, all right, well, I'm never going to leave my house and then I'll be completely safe, right? My vulnerability index will go down dramatically because I'll never leave my bedroom. We have to go about our lives. We have to go about our daily routine and do these things. But if we are, as you say, conscious and aware of what it is that we're doing, the steps that we are taking to protect ourselves, and then again our vulnerabilities, just being aware of those vulnerabilities, in many cases they don't eliminate the vulnerabilities, but they can help mitigate those vulnerabilities.
Exactly. And the whole point of this is not to keep us from doing the things that we want to do. It's to enable us to do the things that we want to do. Is it more fun if I go to Mardi Gras? Is it more fun if I go on a business trip to Detroit? Is it more fun if I go on vacation to the beach if I come back without having been attacked or been mugged? Or is it, am I enjoying it more if I am aware and I'm not concerned about driving down that street or what time I'm going to get home? To me, that form of preparation, like we wrote when you and I talked a couple of weeks ago, preparation enables us to enjoy our lives more fully rather than less fully.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Clay, I appreciate you coming on the program. It was a fantastic column. Folks can check it out at America's First Freedom online. And I look forward to talking to you again very soon, sir.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me on, Cam.
Absolutely. Have a great weekend. Clay Turner, creative director at America's First Freedom, talking about your vulnerability index. We've got the link to Clay's piece at Cam and Company on the Twitters. Tony Katz coming up on the program in just a little bit. But I mentioned a few minutes ago, we talk about what's going on in Alabama. Public hearing on legislation this week on a bill there in Alabama that would allow for the transportation and carrying of a firearm in a vehicle without a concealed carry permit. Hearing this week in Alabama, current law in the state, according to Montgomery Advertiser, allows drivers to carry pistols in cars if they are unloaded and out of arm's reach. A concealed carry permit is needed to carry a loaded firearm. This measure would do away with that restriction. The Montgomery Advertiser quoted Lee County Sheriff Jay Jones. Says existing permit law has led to the arrest of people who were planning home invasions or assaults. And he said passing the law would mean a, quote, reduction in the safety of citizens in Alabama and for our police officers in communities as well. He said, please don't take this law off the books. Advocates of the law, said that this is a self-defense measure. This is a pro-Second Amendment measure. And the bill's sponsor, Senator Gerald Allen, who has introduced the bill actually in all three sessions of the legislature before, says that he's hoping that the measure will see success this year. The state Senate approved the legislation in the first special session last year. The House there in Alabama did not take it up. The Senate Judiciary Committee did not vote on the bill on Wednesday. So if you're an Alabama gun owner, make sure that you let your opinion and your voices be heard there with your state senator there in the state of Alabama. Now, we were also talking about in Maine this ballot measure on quote-unquote universal background checks that apparently will be on the ballot this November. Lawmakers in Maine are also taking a look at some legislation. LD 1572, legislative document 1572, is going to get a public hearing next week, February 24th, before the Joint Committee on Criminal Justice and Public Safety. This is an important bill. It would prevent public housing authorities from adding provisions in rental agreements that would ban the lawful ownership, use, possession, bearing, or transportation of firearms by tenants. We have seen this issue come up in states around the country before. You, during our commercial breaks, if you watch online here, you'll see on occasion, you may have seen on cable television, the NRA's Freedom Safest Place spot featuring Josephine Byrd, a woman from Delaware who successfully sued the Wilmington Housing Authority for telling her that she could not keep a firearm in her home for self-defense because she lived in public housing. Again, your rights are not contingent on your zip code. Your rights are not contingent on the population density of where you live. Your rights are not contingent on the government telling you, we don't allow guns in our subsidized housing. It is your right. LD 1572 introduced after Harvey Limbaugh filed a lawsuit against his landlord. You remember Harvey Limbaugh? We had his story a few months ago. He had moved to this apartment in 2009. His home had been burglarized five times. Harvey Limbaugh is disabled. He decided to purchase a firearm for his protection. Less than a day after he bought his firearm, he had to defend himself in a home invasion. And his landlord, despite the fact that Harvey was acting in self-defense, landlord said, listen, we've got a no guns allowed policy. You're out, Harvey. You can't stay here. You violated your lease by defending your life. And so Harvey Limbaugh has filed a lawsuit. But State Senator Andre Cushing has introduced LD 1572 because we don't want to see other Harvey Limbaughs out there. This shouldn't be any more than well, we're really glad that you're alive and good for you for defending yourself. But in doing so, you violated company policy and therefore we're going to have to fire you for defending your life. Again, there's no way that doesn't come off as just wrong, right? And there's really no way that a landlord is going to come off in the right in the court of public opinion by saying, listen, we're happy that Mr. Limbaugh survived. We're glad. We're very glad of that. But at the same time, you know, we got this policy that says you're not supposed to have guns in your home. So we're kind of in a rock and a hard place here, right? I mean, we don't want to be bad guys, but you violated the policies that we have here. So we're kicking them out. Again, I don't think there's any way that the court of public opinion says, hell yeah, good for you. I'm pretty sure the court of public opinion is always going to come down on the side of the person who defended their life. If these stories get covered, that is, right? Well, again, This would be an easy legislative fix. LD 1572, preventing public housing authorities from adding provisions in rental agreements that would bar legal gun owners from the lawful possession and the ownership and the use and the bearing or transportation of firearms by their tenants. Again, this is going to be a committee hearing before the Joint Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice there in the state of Maine, coming up next Wednesday, February 24th. If you can't make it there in person, Mainers, make sure that your state legislators have heard from you on this issue. Because, again, this is an issue that we've dealt with in states. We don't have an overreaching federal decision here. Not just in Delaware. There was a case a few years before that in the state of Virginia challenging the bans on possession of firearms in public housing. And, again, if you believe that we have a right to keep and bear arms, you have a right of self-defense, well, then how can the government say in the housing stock that we, the government, control, we're going to institute that gun ban? We're going to say in the in the properties that that we own and maintain control over, we're not gonna recognize your right to keep and bear arms. Of which, in the Heller decision, the Supreme Court said the core purpose is self-defense. And in your home, there is perhaps no greater zone of security where your rights should be ensured. For the government to say, yeah, not on the stuff that we own, we're going to keep our gun ban in place. Again, to me, that sounds like a really hard case to win in the court of public opinion. I'm sure the anti-gun advocates will try. But got a chance to set things right there in the state of Maine this year. All right, when we come back here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, Tony Katz, I saw today, he was already tweeting. He's starting the weekend off right. He's eating fried chicken and donuts in Indianapolis, where apparently it's not fried chicken and waffles. In Indy, it is fried chicken and donuts. I just know that I am very jealous of Tony Katz. He gets to do these, like, ice cream tasting contests. He goes and does all these crazy food stuff, goes and hangs out at the minor league hockey games, and then on a Friday morning, he's eating chicken and donuts. Hopefully he has recovered from his carb coma and he'll be ready to go after a quick timeout here on NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.
Speaking with Jeff Gorman, he's an MP in Australia and also chairman of the Shooters and Fishers Party Victoria. Welcome, sir, to NRA News.
Thank you.
And welcome to the States.
Thank you. I've been enjoying my nearly 3 weeks now. It's an awesome country. I've only managed to fire a gun once whilst I've been here in the 3 weeks. It's been more or less work, work, work.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, you got to have take a little time to shoot. So tell us, Jeff, it's great we saw you here and we grabbed you, because let's talk about what's happening down in Australia. What's the latest on the fight for gun owners' rights down there?
Well, as you're aware, the current administration here has been using Australia as a poster child.
I noticed that, yes. Yeah.
So I'm here telling people that all is not what it seems. it's a case of, we have all these restrictions in Australia and their public safety value is actually dubious at the best.
Okay, give us for instance.
Well, we have classifications of rifles. In 1996, we had a massacre in Tasmania.
Right.
And as a result of that, there was what was called the National Firearms Agreement was forced upon the states. Now, that classifies firearms into different sorts of firearms. A and B category are the normal sort of bolt actions and pump action rifles,
right,
and the usual sort of stuff. C category is for .22 semi-automatics and some centerfire rifles, and D category is for all the evil black rifles and so on.
They're so evil.
Now, with the B category, which is the general sort of centerfire thing, you can get pump action rifles, which is fine. But if the pump action rifle looks like an AR-15, for instance, it gets reclassified to the D category, which is all but impossible for a normal person to have. So it looks apparently kill.
Well, Jeff, the devil's in the details, and the bureaucrats really run the world because they, with the paperwork and the machinations, they can make what seemingly innocuous regulations, Jeff, be very much not so.
Yeah, and that's the point I'm trying to bring. First of all, I mean, for our politicians, is if there's no actual public safety outcome to it, why are we doing it? I mean, I've been a policeman in Australia before, in Victoria. I understand the need for, in our country, some rules that may or may not apply here. I'm not here to tell you how to run your country. But reclassifying a firearm based on its looks, because apparently that's bad. I mean, there is no actual reason for that except an ideological push to get rid of firearms.
Speaking with Jeff Borman, he's an MP down in Australia. He's also chairman of the Shooters and Fishers Party of Victoria. All right, Jeff, so let's recap so far, because I have more I want to talk to you about.
Sure.
All the stuff that the current administration is going around touting about how great everything is in Australia with gun laws, not exactly true.
No. Well, let's also, another thing they talk about, the theft of firearms from legitimate owners feeding the black market.
Right.
And they've also coined a term called the grey market, which is for firearms that weren't handed back in 1996.
Okay.
But that's just a cynical way of trying to tie the law-abiding people into the criminals, because what they're saying is these people just didn't hand in these guns. So they're either black or white, as far as I'm concerned. It's either legal or illegal. Right. There is no grey market.
Right. A legal gun is an illegal gun.
Yeah.
Right.
So, look, and effectively, the trying to use us as a poster child for gun control is just, it's unbelievable. The mainstream media, of course, don't want to have a bar of us. They don't want to have that discussion.
No.
Because we bring a narrative that completely opposes what they say.
It's easier for them just not to talk to you.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. I mean, I got to say, I haven't had the mainstream media beating down my door to put me on some of these shows where they talk about gun control. But maybe my invitation got lost in the mail.
Yeah, perhaps. Spam email or something like that.
Well, you just can't tell.
Yeah. So what's your reaction? You've been up here in the States in a few weeks. What's been your reaction from folks up here to what you have to say?
It's been fantastic. I'm finding a lot of people, so they'll say to me, oh, look, they'll get my guns over my cold dead hands and the Second Amendment and so on. But I also point out, people that come to these shows and the Dallas Safari Club convention where I was, they're law-abiding people, they're good people, they put into society. I ask them, do you really want to shoot a policeman that comes to your door to get your guns, or do you want to get shot by them and all this sort of thing? And I think the message I bring from that is, don't rely on the Second Amendment as such. You need to get yourself registered to vote, and you need to punish the people that are trying to take your guns away from you when you've done nothing wrong in the ballot box. And that way you avoid the whole problem.
Almost out of time. Just want to thank you, sir, for what you're doing, and thanks for being on Entering News.
My pleasure.
Welcome back. Thanks for joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Well, I'm not sure I want candy. I want chicken and donuts. That's what I want. I want what Tony Katz had today. Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News on WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana, is with us. How are you, Tony?
I'm good, man. What's going on?
Well, you tell me. First of all, chicken and donuts, is that a thing? Is that an indie thing?
Well, I think they're trying, at least at General American Donut, where I was today, to make it a thing. One of the great donut shops in America, and in Indianapolis, we've got quite a few, a lot of really good bakers, a lot of really good creative minds, and it was fried chicken, and it was, you know, it came with the regular glazed donut, which is spectacular.
Yeah.
And yeast donuts is something that India is known for because of a place called Long's, L-O-N-G apostrophe S. Long's Bakery is famous for their yeast donuts. But you could have done it with a Reese's peanut butter donut or with the salted caramel, and either one of those would have been fine choices.
See, I am so glad that there is, it's easily 40 miles to a donut shop for me. I am so happy for that, because otherwise I would just roll into the studio every day with tasty, tasty donuts in my belly. So I'm glad that I don't have any good donut shops right near me.
Yeah, sure. That sounds perfectly American.
Seriously, that's my weak spot. Good for you. So I've got to ask you, Carrier And the layoffs there, 1,500 jobs moving to Mexico. The video of this being announced sort of went viral. Is this something that you've been talking about there on the morning show?
Yeah, and certainly it was a very big subject when it first happened last week. It's something that we, you know, the video was out here in Indianapolis immediately, and we talked about it. It was maybe the highest ranking story we had for over a week at WIBC.com. And it's been a real subject of not division here, but of disgusting, shameless politics here. 1,400 people are going to be losing their jobs in Indianapolis starting in 2017. Another 700 in a place called Huntington, Indiana, 2,100 in all. You've got Governor Mike Pence, a Republican. You've got Joe Hogsett, the mayor of Indianapolis, a Democrat. You have Senator Coates, a Republican, Senator Donnelly, a Democrat, and others all working to figure out what they can do regarding Carrier. While they may not all be super big fans of unions, they're certainly a super big fan of these 1,400 people and their families and want to keep them in jobs the best that they can. You certainly want to keep a manufacturing tech base like Carrier around. It seems to be really a wages issue, which could also be a regulation issue, something I discuss quite a bit. With wages and benefits, it costs $34 an hour for a employee here in Indianapolis, Indiana. It will cost $6 an hour in Mexico. That's something the Carrier feels is a business decision that they'll have to do, but the way they did it will hurt them. The real story here is the shameless politics of it. John Gregg, who is the Democrat running for governor, has put out ads on Facebook showing a moving truck saying Governor Mike Pence gave Carrier Corporation tax credits, and now they're moving to Mexico. As if somehow Governor Pence is the problem. He's campaigning shamelessly on the backs of these 1,400 people who lost their jobs. And a guy by the name of Scott Pilaf, who is the House Minority Leader here in Indiana, he represents a place called Michigan City, he started discussing the fact that, you know, this is just endemic of a bigger problem of GOP policies. And, you know, if we had more LGBT protections, that might have helped Carrier stay as well. I kid you not. These 1,400 people and their families are not going to have jobs in another year. And he's pushing a social justice warrior angle. Scott Pilaf and John Gregg, two more reasons why Democrats should not be allowed to win in Indiana.
That's amazing. I mean, look, as you talk about, here is the crux of the matter, right? If the workers who will be employed by Carrier in Mexico are going to make $3 an hour, right, and the employees there in Indiana are going to make as you say, with benefits included, what, $34 an hour?
Yeah, the number you're using is the 3 and 20 number that you see quoted a lot. Just straight dollars for dollars in terms of per hour salary.
Yeah,
it's $20 on average here in Indiana, in Indianapolis, $3 in Mexico.
So, I mean,
not including benefits and other things.
So let's just start with the math. I mean, right there, you know, and as you say, this is an issue that not just Indiana and not just Indianapolis is going to have to deal with and has been dealing with. This is an issue that American manufacturing jobs have had to deal with. And it's not just Mexico. It is China as well. It's, you know, where things can be made far more cheaply than they are here in the United States. Companies are going to try to make them far more cheaply than they do in the United States. How do we recover?
And they will. And to that, my only consideration for them would be, you know, you get what you pay for. I would say that to any employer, any manufacturer. And if you really feel you can get the same quality in Mexico, then I don't have anything else to say to that. But there is a way to do these things. And when you watch that video, some people can disagree with me if they will. It's beyond the condescending video of the way these people got told. First of all, when that video took place, when they got told that's the first anybody heard of it, the governor's office here in Indiana, I spoke with Governor Mike Pence, they were never notified. The mayor's office here in Indianapolis, never notified. The Indiana Economic Development Council, which engages some of those tax credits, never notified. The Department of Energy, which gave them a $5.1 million tax credit for the development of some eco-nonsense furnace, never notified. They didn't tell anybody. They announced to the floor, to the rank and file in the building. man, there's no coming back from that. You're going to have to deal with that. I just don't think they ever imagined somebody would have cell phone video. Because if you didn't see that happen, you wouldn't be as just, like, royally pissed as you are right now.
Right. No, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting. There's a book that came out July of 2014, so about a year and a half ago. It's called Factory Man. And it was written by a reporter in the Roanoke, Virginia newspaper. And it's about, you know, Bassett Furniture, right? So it's about one of the Bassetts. And the subtitle of this book, Factory Man, How One Furniture Maker Battled Offshoring, Stayed Local, and Helped Save an American Town. And it's a fantastic book if you want to look at the challenges that American businesses face who want to keep American jobs here when things can be made so much cheaper overseas. And you've got to be creative. You might not be able to save every job, but it's a fascinating look at how you can try to keep your jobs here on American soil. And I don't know if anybody at Carriers, you know, got any time to read here. It might be a little late there, but
and I think it's very well going to be a little late here. But the bigger conversation is, look at what you must do to try and save a job in America. Shouldn't we stop and take pause at that? I mean, what do we have to do to save a job in America? Shouldn't that be the default? Shouldn't that be the easier position? Shouldn't that be the more desirous position? Isn't that clearly the better option? The American worker, American ingenuity, American know-how, American safety, American creativity. Isn't that what we should want in a workforce, or any company should want in a workforce? So what is it that we're doing via legislation and regulation to make that difficult? Let's take a look at that if we want to talk about saving the jobs. I mean, interesting, I'll gladly check the book out, but it's interesting that we go from this default of how difficult it is, and that we don't ask ourselves, well, why the bloody hell do we make it so difficult?
No, I think that there is a great deal of that. But I also think, too, and I don't know that this is, you know, I don't think this is happening with a Carrier in Mexico, but certainly with China in the furniture industry, you've got a government that was apparently willing to subsidize the Chinese furniture industry to undercut the American furniture industry, and it's in many ways it's almost economic warfare that we're playing, or that we're engaged in with a nation like China, where you've got the government through, you know, massive subsidies willing to take big losses in certain industries to try to gain the market share and to try to take jobs away from America. I think it's absolutely taking place right now.
I think I found the Trump fan. I do.
I'm just
who loves the Donald.
I'm just telling you. Listen, I have in all honesty, I have no idea who I'm going to be voting for on March the 1st, but I will say this. I have yet to fall in love with any candidate. I don't expect to fall in love with any candidate, frankly, after watching the you know, a large group of Americans fall in love with Barack Obama in 2008. I don't want to fall in love with a candidate, Tony. I'm not looking to fall in love with a candidate. I'm not looking to be swept off my feet. That's not what I want from a candidate.
That's because you're dead inside. You know, we talk about this a lot on the show. People talk about whether or not Trump has the right temperament. They talk about whether Ted Cruz is smarmy. I've been asked that question point blank. Do you think he's smarmy? Is Marco Rubio nothing but a liar? Because when I see him, I feel this or I feel that. I'm not looking for a boyfriend. I'm looking for a president here. Is he nice? Is he not nice? Those kinds of questions. You know, what did he lie about? Did he put out an ad that someone could question? Hey, that's not, you know, the nicest thing to do. Well, that's not a lie. It might not be nice, but this is politics. Politics that ain't nice. They're trying to become president. They're not trying to lead the PTA, which is, by the way, far more cutthroat depending on your community that you live in. I'm with you. I don't need to be swept off my feet. I don't need to love you. I just need you to do your job. I'll leave the money on the dresser.
I understand. I don't even know where to go with that.
You know where to go with that.
I do, but I can't. This is so family friendly, even though on Sirius Patriot we're on, it's almost like 3 o'clock in the morning right now. Still can't do it. To that end, we do certainly though see on the Republican side, I think with every candidate out there, there are supporters who are in love with those candidates. On the Democratic side, we see this as well. Although, Tony, I think it is fair to say now that really the love affair on the left right now is between Bernie Sanders and a lot of young voters.
Well, how in the world do you love Hillary Clinton? talk about leaving your money on the nightstand. It's the only way that one's going to get done. You can't get love unless you pay that woman. The Clinton Global Initiative proves that. Lock, stock, and barrel. How do you love Hillary? How do you like Hillary? How do you get behind Hillary? How do you enjoy Hillary? I mean, the level of which you must have self-loathing and hate, a sincere desire not only to hurt yourself but to hurt others. You literally have to be Lena Dunham to support Hillary Clinton. And that's who you have to be. There's just nothing worthwhile there. Bernie's fun. No, he's exciting. And he's taken it to her, and he painted her as establishment, and now she's embracing it. Heck, she had an event where she said, you know, Bernie Sanders wasn't even a Democrat until he ran for president, and they boo her. She's totally right, and they're still booing her. Man, it's game over. But I hope the superdelegates continue to do this job of stealing the vote of the average person in order to ensure that Hillary is the nominee, because Hillary is totally, totally beatable in November, but it won't be Hillary. I said it on this program. I meant it. I've said it before. I'll say it again. It will be go to the floor of the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia, and it will be Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren. I want you to put it down like you would on all your cash on 23 Rouge. Put it down. This bet's coming true.
I'm not going to bet against this. I'm not predicting anything this election year other than it's going to continue to be the weirdest campaign that I've ever seen in my life. But so Biden Warren, that would not surprise me one bit. Biden was asked again whether or not he would support either of the candidates, and he said, I'd support either one, but I'd do things differently too. So I think Biden is certainly keeping it open that hey, if you need me, I'm here. I'm here for you, America. All right, Tony, we've only got about 60 seconds left. Plans this weekend? Going to do anything fun? Eat more donuts?
I am moderating the debate in the 9th Congressional District here in Indiana for the Republicans running for Congress, 10 a.m. Tomorrow morning at Martinsville High School. I'll be moderating that debate, so I've got a night of finishing up the prep for myself, and then heading out early because I've been told I need to get breakfast at Forky's. That's right, Forky's, where they've got the $8.99 all-you-can-eat buffet, including the drink. Now, I ask you, I live in a place with donuts and fried chicken and $8.99 all-you-can-eat buffets. Tell me what the farm's got.
We did just have a cigar store open up two doors down from us.
Oh, well, congratulations. We have award-winning cigar bars like Glenn and Nick Blaine. We've got great old-school cigar bars like CarMax and Cigar Haven. And we've got all-you-can-eat buffet places at for $8.99 called Forky's.
We don't have that in Farmville.
That's with an F. I've seen Forky's 1 and Forky's 2.
Tony, enjoy the breakfast buffet. Have a great time at the debate. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll talk to you again soon, man.
Forky's.
All right. Stick a fork in it. We are done here. Enjoy your weekend. We'll see you here soon with another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nonstop.